Committee will come to order. We have several bills on the agenda for today. I'm going to make this announcement twice. We don't have another meeting of the regular tax committee scheduled for the remainder of the year so far. There may be some other issues that need to be heard later, and we will schedule hearings at that point. But if folks are aware of bills that really need a hearing before the end of session, please let us know that now in the next day or two so we can schedule a hearing as appropriate. First up on our agenda this morning is Senate File 275, Senator Jungbauer, Anoka County's Financing of Public Safety Improvements. Good morning, Senator Jungbauer. Welcome.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members. Happy to be here today. It's a great time of day to look around and see who's the morning people and who are the night people. Members, Senate File 275 is fairly simple. It's a being able to use or extend bonding we've used for our public safety for things like 800 megahertz radio, but we want to extend that out to kind of complete the system now where actually in Anoka County, sadly, we have a high error rate of input on data on incidents. And part of that comes, members, is when you get a 911 call in a squad car, it shows up on your computer, but you can't just cut and paste that information. You have to go back and re-enter the information on those kind of calls. So we want to be able to have the money to set up different programs for that so that you can cut and paste, literally, that you can integrate these systems. And a number of other entities around the state of Minnesota are doing that same thing with their public safety dollars, and we want to use this bonding authority to be able to do that. As well, I have here with me for Senate File 275 resolutions from the cities in Anoka County in support of using this bonding authority for that continuation of the improvement on our public safety system. And with me this morning, I have our county attorney, Tony Palumbo, and he'll give you some further information.
Mr. Palumbo, thank you, Senator. To the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tony Palumbo. I'm the Anoka County attorney. In addition, I'm also chair of a joint powers board in Anoka County called the Joint Law Enforcement Council, which has been around for over 40 years. The Joint Law Enforcement Council is a collaboration of all 11 law enforcement agencies in Anoka County, plus fire representation, plus other members of the public safety team in Anoka County, including our central dispatch, elected members of the cities and the county in Anoka County. We have, throughout our 40-year history, collaborated on many projects. Most recently was our 800 megahertz project, and that is the statute before you today, which we are seeking the amendment of, to be able to expand the authority from the 800 megahertz bonding authority to be able to now include a public safety data system. The system which we are proposing is a computer system that would link all our public safety partners, both law enforcement and fire, as well as our jail, as well as our dispatch center and emergency management, to be on essentially one data system, to be able to communicate more efficiently, to have collaboration, and as Senator Jungbauer stated, to reduce any errors. Currently, when you have various members of the public safety agencies entering data, there is always subject for human error. Once that human error occurs, there is created what's called a suspense file, which means the file is not attached to the correct individual. And unfortunately, we have a very high rate in Anoka County of 14% of those, and we're trying to work on that. We feel this would be one method of trying to reduce that error and also create efficiencies among all of our public safety partners in Anoka County. As we have said, it is a countywide project. The Anoka County has elected to undertake the funding of this through a bonding authority. We are not asking for contributions from cities, but as Senator Jungbauer has indicated, we have resolutions from all the municipalities in Anoka County going on record in support of this particular project. I could go on and on, but I think right about now brevity is probably better than length. So I'll defer to the committee for any questions.
Mr. Palumbo, I have a question. It's a little unusual to bond for personal property, and so I'm wondering if you could expand on that just a little bit. Are they assets that will last a long time, and what is the useful life of these assets to the county?
Senator, the length of the bond we anticipate is 10 years. It is rather unusual, a bond for personal property, but we do feel this system, our current system is over 12 years old now. And we are hoping, obviously, to design a system that will be capable of being upgraded as we go along. So while it's very difficult to determine what the computer arena will be like 10 years from now, but we do feel that we will have a foundation in place that certainly can be enhanced throughout the course of the time of its useful life. So,
there is a fiscal note, members. It shows that there's no impact to the state here. Questions or comments, Senator Limmer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Colombo, of the $12.5 million for the bonds, what proportion of that is in real property versus personal property?
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, it will not be a 12.5 million. I'm sorry, that would be the limit. We are anticipating this project would cost between $3.5 and $5.5 million for this particular project. Of that, we do not anticipate any part of it would be real property. It would go towards the public safety data system.
And Madam Chair, what would be the proportion of dollars for the personal property, dollar amount wise?
I believe, Senator, would be the entire amount at this point would go towards the computer system, which would be 100% towards that system and not for real property. We do not anticipate buying any real estate for this.
Madam Chair, I'm confused because on line 11, the front page, the amount of financing is to include real and personal property on line 11. So we're authorizing the county to invest this bonding money for real and personal property. So real property is definitely there. So that's why I'm raising the question.
Senator Limmer, I'm sorry, I'm looking at, could you just restate the line again? Did you say
line 11?
Line 11.
1.11.
Senator, all I can say is my understanding is that the project we are going forward today is for personal property. I expect that was drafted with the idea that should we need to purchase in the future a real property, we certainly would have the authority to do so under this legislation.
All right, Madam Chair. So what we're really doing is kind of giving you the opportunity to extend a loan up to $12.5 million, and your county has a plan to invest 3-point-something of that right now in personal property, namely computer equipment. But we're giving the county the flexibility to use up to $12.5 million for real estate or real property improvements. Would that characterize this bill?
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, I believe so under the wording of the bond or of the legislation proposed.
Mr. Plumbo, are you asking for more authority than you really need here and asking us for a further departure than you need? I think I'm following Senator Limmer's thinking here, and the language that was in current law says that you can fund a communication system infrastructure and improvements. I guess we're adding the word improvements, but I'm not sure you need that terminology, including real and personal property. For sure not real property. That's not your intention. Am I hearing you correctly?
Well, Senator, Madam Chair, it is not our intention at this time under this project to purchase real property. But we are asking the authority so that the county certainly could go outside its net levy limits and be able to put this as an independent expenditure on any sort of tax bill so that it would have transparency.
Well, Mr. Plumbo, can you already go beyond the levy limits for this purpose, it being public safety?
Madam Chair, I do not know if we can go beyond our levy limits for public safety. I'm not sure that's a recognized exception to go beyond. I may be wrong, but I can't say that I'm an authority in that area.
Well, I think indebted is too. But Ms. Zoff can hopefully answer that question.
Madam Chair, members, typically the levy limit laws, which will actually not be in effect after this year, typically, though, they do include an exception for debt service. So, but this bill also does, you know, provide that it's not, this particular debt is not included in the computation of the net debt limit under general law, and that's also a feature that we often see in these special bonding authorizations. So there's the levy limits, which would not apply, and then there is the exception to the net debt limit for these.
Senator Howell.
Madam Chair, I've got a similar question on the change there at 2.7 and 2.8. I think I heard you say that you needed 10 years, but we've stricken that in this bill, and we've inserted 2027, which appears to be at least 15 years, and I'm wondering what the need is to change it to 10 years, from 10 years.
Madam Chair, Senator Howell, my understanding is that was the limit of the first bond that was issued for the 800 megahertz, and what we are asking for now is a 15-year limit to be able to certainly include our public safety system within the 10-year, and if there's additional projects to go up to the 15 years. My understanding is that we have to have statutory authority for the limit of the bonds. So we elect to go beyond the 10 years or elect to expand. We would need to be able to have legislation that would cover the bonding period.
Madam Chair, follow.
Senator Howell.
It says here, the language we're striking says 10 years after the first year in which the county issues a note or bond under this section. So I guess just clarify, you just said that you needed 10 years, and now we're putting an actual date of January 1st, 2027. Just, are you expecting that 6 years from now you're going to do something and you're going to need that out that far, that in 2017 you're going to come up with a project and you'll need it 10 years from there?
Madam Chair, Senator Howell, I think that was some of the thought behind drafting this particular statute in the event that there are other things that are needed for the public safety system that we don't know about now that may come up within the next 5 years. We would like to be able to obviously finance that also within a 10-year period. We don't anticipate going beyond the 15 years.
I guess my exceed that, so. Madam Chair, my question is then why do we require him to come here at all if we're just going to give a open? Why wouldn't we require the county to come back and make the case to incur more debt? Or I mean.
Senator Howe, and Senator Jungbauer, I think there's a theme here that we want to make sure you're really accomplishing in this bill what you're telling us you need and not beyond that, because there will be others that will come back to us and ask for the same kind of general authority to go beyond the actual needs. And I think we're struggling with that a little bit. Are there other folks from Anoka County that are here to testify? Perhaps the county administrator is here or someone representing the county board that could speak to this?
Madam Chair, the county board chair was intending to be here, but it had to be at a meeting this morning, unfortunately, to make sure there was a quorum.
So. Well, I think that the concerns I'm hearing is there are folks that want to help you here. I'm not sure about the language on 1.11 referencing real and personal property. And I'm not sure about the January 1, 2027. I think you may want to reconsider whether that's what you truly need and want us to vote on here this morning, Mr. Palumbo, Senator Jungbauer. We have other bills on the agenda that we can take up while you huddle and give some thought to that, unless there are other folks that would like to testify about those concerns. Senator Jungbauer.
That would be fine, Madam Chair. We will go discuss that. But in my notes as well, and I'll have to clarify that, it does say in my notes that the county could put it under its normal levy authority, and we're asking it for it to be outside the normal levy authority, that we need that statutory authority to put it outside of that.
Well, and Senator Jungbauer, I don't think anybody here has questioned that part of your proposal. I think that it just goes in, it goes more broadly than necessary. I mean, there are some things here that you're not even asking for or don't seem to be able to articulate a need for that are included here, and that gives us some pause. So what's really happening if that's not what you need?
That's a fair analogy, Madam Chair, members. We will go clarify those things, find the right people so we can get it done, and we'll step out for as long as necessary. You can have your other testifiers come up. Thank you.
Before you go, Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and maybe Senate Counsel could help me, but isn't the purpose of this bill so that they can bond for computers?
Madam Chair, Senator Scoy, I'm not sure if they're intending to use it, this authority for computers specifically. I believe the intent of the bill is just to broaden the authority that, you know, current law authorized them to use this authority to acquire public safety communication system infrastructure and equipment. And the way this is drafted is it gives them broader authority for public safety improvements. It strikes the language referring to communication system infrastructure. And then it gives them additional time to use that bonding authority. The current law says that the authority lapses, or the section expires 10 years after the first year in which the county issues a note or bond. This would extend the expiration date to January 1st of 2027. So just in general, it gives them a little bit broader authority for the uses and gives them some more time, and then also takes care of the net debt limit.
Thank you, Ms. Soff and Madam Chair. My concern with this is, you know, if they were bonding for real property, it wouldn't be an issue. But they're bonding for electronics, which, as Senator Limmer brought up, are pretty short-term stuff. And the dates, according to Senator Howell, looks like 15 years. It's pretty problematic, I would think.
Well, Senator Scoy, I think many of us share your concerns. The history has been that if you could show that the infrastructure needs, like the antennas or something like that, were going to last, you know, 10, 20, 30 years, it made a lot of sense to bond for that. And I think that's what was included when we talked about communication system infrastructure. I think that was our general understanding in the tax committee about what we were doing here. So I think we just need more specificity in your proposal about what you need, and, you know, so we can vote and make sure you've clarified as best you can. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and Senator Scoy, I think this is a problem or an issue that we're getting into now, because we're relying on computers and communication systems, especially in law enforcement, much heavier. The price is going up. We've had this discussion for just a few years in Senate finance committees, and local political subdivisions are scratching their head thinking, how can we satisfy the public safety needs by getting the proper equipment, communication gear that they need, and yet at the same time the high cost. And so we've all been looking at the use of bonding as, is it something appropriate for this infrastructure need? And it's causing a dilemma. The public discussion is a dilemma that we're running into. You've got computers that seem to change rather quickly in what they can do, and yet we're financing it on long-term notes. And so that's just a dilemma, and we have to ask the question, is that where we're going? In this particular case, the testimony as well as the handout says that they only need up to $3.5 to $5.5 million, but they're asking for $12.5 million in bonding authority, and there's a line on line 11 that it also gives them the authority to use it for real property as well as personal property, but all of the discussion so far is only on computers, personal property. So that's why we're having the discussion that we're having.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Limmer, this is not a new debate.
Right.
When I was on the county board, we were having this exact same debate about the E-911. And you need to kind of step back and say, are you going to allow bonding for these non-real property things? And at that point, we didn't. In our little county, we said, no, go find some other source of revenue, use your E-911 funds, figure out some levy, something else, but bonding isn't appropriate for this type of equipment. And, if we start doing this here for this county, I mean, you're going to have 87 other ones sitting at that table asking for the same thing.
I never felt that quite so much as I do now. I agree. And yeah, we've had a lot of these types of proposals where people are seeking expanded authority, and I know what's going to happen is we're going to end up back here next year again with all these communities asking for the same thing. So we have to be careful, and nobody can say we don't read the bills in the Senate Tax Committee.
Yeah.
Senator Skoy, would you move to lay this bill on the table? And Senator Jungbauer, Madam Chair,
could
I take it under consideration?
Answer a little bit of what Senator Skoy said?
Certainly,
before.
Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Skoy, is my understanding, talking to the board members, and I don't know how it fits bonding authority, but I was just told we could do it in 10 years, and the real and personal property was standard language, and still we put it in there because we weren't sure about the infrastructure. But the major part of the issue is now you have 800 megahertz radio systems. You can talk to each other. Fire can talk to police and things like that. Where the problem comes today in the system, and you will have other people coming back, is developing the programs, not the computers, because the computers aren't the issue. It's developing the software and whatever other infrastructure you need so that the different computer systems can talk to each other and you can cut and paste literally what's coming in. So if you get something from 911 and it goes on a police computer, the simplest part to explain is you cannot cut that information and paste it into the program for the report. All that stuff has to be manually put back in. So what we're talking about is developing a system, and it may require some real property in order to accomplish it, but to be able to make those systems integrate so that there aren't mistakes and it actually saves time, and it will save FTEs in the long run. It will save people money to be able to integrate these because it will be a lot less time in putting reports together for all law enforcement. And some cities and counties may have figured out this already and been able to fit it within their normal bonding. In Anoka County, we have not figured out that whole solution. So that's why the real and personal, we're not sure how much of it might be infrastructure. We can figure out, I think we know a cap, and we can come back and tighten all that up. But the 10 years we know we can live with, and we'll figure out what the cap needs to be. I think we've got enough people that we've talked to about developing this infrastructure. But it is not the physical computers. It's the infrastructure, programming, and whatever else. So all these things can talk to each other, and you can take those programs and overlap them and use them without having to re-enter things. So it gets to today, it gets re-entered in the squad car, gets put into the report, whether it's in the squad or when he sits to do a report. Then it goes back and it has to get re-entered by somebody else at another computer. So there's a minimum of three times most of these things get input directly by hand, and sometimes as many as five, and that's why you get these error rates. So we're trying to figure out the integrated program and the infrastructure to keep that from happening so that people can literally take the report and cut and paste whatever parts are pertinent to the next person down the line.
Let us know of your progress. Senator Skoy would like to move. Yes?
Yeah, Madam Chair, based on the work, and Senator Jungbauer, I get the issue, but the question is how it's going to pay for it. That's what needs to be understood. I'll move Senate File 275 be laid on the table for possible inclusion.
Not debatable. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. The motion is adopted. The bill's on the table. Senator Jungbauer, let us know if you have, if you'd like us to take it up again. Next on the agenda, let's see if I can find my agenda. Senator Fischbach. We have Sauk Rapids. Senator Fischbach, is this your first time in the Tax Committee this year?
Yes, so thank you very much.
Can you bring coffee for everyone, Senator Fischbach?
No, just run upstairs to your office and use the K-Cup machine.
Donuts?
I have been in there late at night to get coffee. But I really do appreciate you hearing this bill, Madam Chair, because I know it came to our attention very recently, and so to be able to be here and hear the bill today, I really do appreciate it. And, you know, the bill is very simple. Senate File 1336 is very simple. Basically, it just gives an exception for a parcel of land that we need to have that exception from the TIF, the TIF and the Green Acres Law for the development. I do have an author's amendment. The A1, it just was inadvertently, a parcel number was left out. So if someone would be willing to offer that.
Madam Chair, I would move the amendment.
Senator Sundholm would move the A1 amendment. It was just handed out, members. It occurred to the author. I hope you will all support this amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. A1 is adopted.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. And like I said, it's a very simple bill. Just offers an exception to some of the parcels so that we are able to go ahead with the development. And I do have with me the Community Development Director, Todd Schultz, and one of the Sauk Rapids City Council members, Jared Kapinski. So, and I know they have some things that they'd like to offer. So I think Mr. Schultz will start out.
Thank you, Senator. And Mr. Schultz, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Again, I'm Todd Schultz. I'm the Community Development Director for the City of Sauk Rapids. For the couple of you who might not know where Sauk Rapids is, we're oftentimes confused with Sauk Center. We're both in central Minnesota. Sauk Rapids is actually separated from the city of St. Cloud by the Mississippi River. And the reason that that's relevant is that we are the only community in the St. Cloud marketplace that is entirely within Benton County. Benton County is, from a tax perspective, one of more struggling counties in the state from an economic perspective, and they're at a little bit of a disadvantage with their county across the river, Stearns County, which is where St. Cloud and the other communities in the St. Cloud marketplace are currently located. Our particular project is an apartment project, and it's a project that we've been working on for approximately 7 years. Because of the economic disparities that exist on our side of the river as opposed to the other side of the river, there have been a number of apartments that have been built in the St. Cloud marketplace over the past 10 years, but they've all been on the west side of the river, the St. Cloud side of the river. None of them have occurred on our side of the river. And we've been talking to developers about why that is for a number of years, and it really comes down to two things. Taxes are higher on our side of the river than they are on the other side of the river, as I've already stated. And because of the county we're located in, the rents that the developer can get on our side of the river are less than they can get on the other side of the river. And so we're at a little bit of a disadvantage. And so because of that, we recognize that we have to put a little bit more into the game. We have to participate a little bit more in order to get folks to take interest in our community. As I said, we've been working with this developer for 7 years in an attempt to try to make this project happen, but we haven't been able to do that until recently. The jobs bill that was passed by the legislature last year provided us with that last tool that allowed us ultimately to come to an understanding or an agreement with this developer in principle to make this project happen. And that happened about 30 days ago. When that happened, we started the process of setting up and creating an economic development TIF district. And shortly after that process began, we discovered that we had an issue relating to Green Acres. The developer last year, while we were in negotiations, enrolled his property in Green Acres, not understanding that there was a TIF consequence in doing that. It was his understanding that he would have the ability in the event that our project went forward to just pull his property out of Green Acres and pay his back taxes and on we would go. Not understanding that, in fact, there was a conflict between the Minnesota Jobs Bill and in this Green Acres legislation. In the Green Acres legislation actually trumps the jobs bill. I contacted the county to talk about what kind of education takes place, or is there something that's provided to folks when they come in to talk about enrolling their acreage in Green Acres. And they provided me with a fact sheet that was put together by the Minnesota Department of Revenue, and I brought extras along in case anybody would like to see it. That fact sheet talks about the pros and cons of Green Acres in the state of Minnesota and why somebody might want to put their property in Green Acres and why they maybe wouldn't want to put their property in Green Acres. But it doesn't anywhere talk about any potential TIF implications or negative consequences from a TIF perspective about enrolling your property in Green Acres. And so in this particular case, the developer simply didn't know that he was putting his project that he was working with us on in jeopardy. For our community, it's a very significant project for a couple of reasons. It's providing a level of housing that currently doesn't exist in our community. It's creating about 60 jobs. And that was really put into perspective for me last week when we were contacted by a local manufacturer who was interested in adding 150 jobs and had contacted myself and the state to inquire into some form of assistance in order to make that happen. And according to the state, this is one of the largest projects they're working on, this 150 jobs in the city of Sauk Rapids. So to add these additional 60 jobs is a very significant project for us. It would add ultimately $300,000 to the tax revenues collectively for the local jurisdictions. And so I guess with that, I've also brought Councilman Jared Kapinski, and I don't know if Jared, you have anything you'd like to add to that?
Councilmember, welcome.
Madam Chair, thank you. Thanks again for having us. I basically came along because this project, this development, is absolutely huge for our community. Our community has been pretty much stagnant for quite a few years, largely due because we can't compete with the neighboring communities with what they have to offer projects and developments going forward. The projects that have came forward over the last couple of years are stalling out due mainly to economic times and financing on their end. This project and development is right at the tip of our corridor, right where all of our development is going to take place over the upcoming years. And with what is going on in our county being a very economic stress county, and what is going on with our city, the largest city in our county, this project would be absolutely huge going forward. And it would spur the growth in our county and our city and help all the taxpayers out in these areas, which is extremely needed. So I just wanted to come along and try and stress that to the committee.
Questions or comments for the testifiers or Senator Fischbach? Senator Howell.
Madam Chair, I'm concerned that what kind of precedence it would set if we allowed, I understand there's a provision, and I'm not sure in here whether it excludes the payback provision or not. That would be one question I'd want to have asked. Does the owner of this have to pay back what the benefit that they got from Green Acres? It appears that he is willing to, and I'm hoping that this law doesn't exempt that. But, there's a lot of doing this runs exactly counter to the idea or the premise behind Green Acres. I mean, Green Acres is to prevent the development. And, I mean, that's the premise of going into Green Acres. And I'm just concerned about the precedent this may set, because I've got a farm that's completely into, well, just about completely into CREP, but who knew what farm prices were going to be like 5, 6, 10 years? And that's a perpetual easement. I'd love to go back and say, geez, I guess I made a mistake. I didn't want to do that. I you should have told me that the farm prices were going to go exponentially up and I could make a lot more money if I just sell it now. So the program is designed to stop the sprawl, urban sprawl, and to provide green spaces and provide a reduction of taxes. And it appears that while this may be great that you're going to have a lot of development here, we're doing an about face, and we know what the premise of the program was for, and now we've got this great opportunity. I'm concerned, and I don't know if council can speak to the precedent that this would set, where somebody could take the state or someone else into court and say, well, you allowed these people to go back and change. And so I guess that's the concern I have. And then I also have the financial concern. I don't know if this language prevents that payback, but I'm certain you'd be willing to pay the money back. It's just that I think it goes beyond that.
Before I ask you to respond, Mr. Schultz, Ms. Zoff can answer Senator Howe's question.
Madam Chair, Senator Howe, this bill doesn't affect the payback of the Green Acres law at all. It just... it's necessary because there is a provision in the tax increment financing law that would prohibit the inclusion of parcels that had been in Green Acres or the Metro Ag Preserve or the Open Space Law for 5 years into a TIF district except in very limited circumstances. So this bill will enable the city to include those parcels, but they will have to be removed from the Green Acres program according to all the provisions, and the payback would still apply.
And that, Madam Chair, that brings another question. When was this land put into Green Acres? If he pulled it out of Green Acres, how long would they have to wait for this development to go forward?
Ms. Pino or Mr. Schultz?
Yeah, Madam Chair, this property was put in last year, and in fact, there hasn't even been a tax advantage yet for the developers. First advantage would be coming up on June 15th, and so at this point, there wouldn't be anything to pay back. But the developer understands that coming this first year is payment June 15th. He would benefit, and he's more than willing to pay back any advantages that he would have received because of that. And I apologize, I forgot the second question.
Senator Howe?
Well, if he takes it out now, how long would he? Well, how long do they have to wait? Is it the 5 years?
Ms.
Howe. Madam Chair, Senator Howe, yes, the provision in the TIF law would say that these parcels couldn't be included into a TIF district for a period of 5 years unless they're used for very specific purposes.
One more question,
Senator Howe.
And I'll be brief. How long, when someone signs it into a program, into the Green Acres, do they have to change their mind, or do they have any time frame? Once they sign it, is it done, or do they have 30 days, or is there anything in statute that gives them, geez, I guess I made a mistake?
Madam Chair, Senator Howe, I don't believe there's anything, I'm not recalling that there's any kind of a look-back provision in the law. I would imagine that maybe some of the county officials may have some flexibility, or you know, if the land hasn't actually been in for you know more than a few days, I would imagine as a practical matter they may let them out. But given the fact that this was this land was actually enrolled last year, and you know I imagine the taxes would have been computed for 2011 based on that Green Acres inclusion, it's a little different. It's not just a question of looking back a few weeks later.
Thank you.
Additional questions or comments? Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What does this land look like? Is this open, productive field, or has this got lots of grass and trees, or what's the land look like?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. This property is on the edge, or actually on the edge of a development that the developer did, single-family development, about 7, 8, 9 years ago. It had been identified in the development plan for an apartment. While the developer has been trying to put a project together with the city, it has been in egg production, I believe, for most of those years, hay and in some cases, corn.
Okay.
Senator Skoy.
No, thank you, Madam Chair. It's just apparent what the purpose of the Green Acres program is from this testimony.
Other questions or comments regarding Senator Fischbach's bill? Are there folks here that would like to testify one way or the other on this bill? Senator Fischbach, what would be your wishes with respect to this bill? I do have a suggestion, which would be to lay the bill over for possible inclusion and then consider it as an amendment in the Tax Conference Committee, unless you want it to proceed separately.
Okay, so you're talking about adding it to the omnibus tax bill that's in conference committee now?
Correct.
Okay. Well, if that's, you know, I would defer to the chair. If that's what you would think would be the best plan for it, that would be fine with me.
Well, that would mean that we would ask you to come back and present again. I wanted to make sure that members here in the Senate had a chance to hear your proposal, and the Senate Tax Committee in particular to have the information necessary on the proposal.
Well, and I appreciate that opportunity. And if that, I would be happy to come back, and I'm sure that Mr. Schultz and Mr. Kopinski and whoever else wanted to would be happy to come back if the conference committee needed more information also.
Madam Chair. Senator Pogemiller.
Madam Chair, I don't know if it matters, but is it either in the House tax bill or the Senate tax bill that's in conference committee?
Senator Pogemiller, I don't believe it is in either one. Senator Fischbach, is it in?
Madam Chair, no, it's not. This came to our attention very, very recently, so we didn't have the opportunity to do that, but no, it is not.
Well, and Senator Pogemiller, the very reason we're hearing this today is to make sure that the Senate has an opportunity to weigh in and consider this provision before it is considered in the Senate or in the Tax Conference Committee. Senator Pogemiller, your guidance would be appreciated. Do you have any suggestions about or concerns about our proceeding in that manner?
Madam Chair, you can do whatever you want, but I think there's a rule that prevents it, but do whatever you want.
Ms. Zoff, are you aware of a rule that you can maybe advise us?
Well, Madam Chair, the rule has been that that the items that are included in a conference committee report should have been in one or another of the bills that come before the committee or that are adopted by the House and that are in conference committee. You know, at times the conference committees reach conclusions that have compromises that incorporate elements that weren't specifically in either of the bills, but they're intended to be sort of an amplification or a compromise of issues that are before the committee.
Madam Chair?
Senator Howe?
Madam Chair, couldn't you re-refer this bill to the Rules Committee for an exception?
Well, Senator Howe, I appreciate your help, trying to help us here. I think, Senator Fischbach, I would recommend that we lay it over for possible inclusion in the policy bill that's going to come out of this committee later on the agenda today. It does not have a financial impact, and so we could include it on Senate File 869, the Omnibus Technical and Policy Non-Budget Bill, and we would not have do any damage to the rules or precedents of the tax committee and the conference committees.
Oh, that would be wonderful, Madam Chair. I would appreciate that. If it fits in the policy bill that you're putting together, that would be great.
Thank you. Questions or comments about that or the manner of proceeding here? Without objection, the chair would like to lay over Senate File 1336 for possible inclusion in the Senate Omnibus Technical and Policy Non-Budget Bill, Senate File 869.
Madam Chair, may I just ask, if you're dealing with that towards the end of the committee hearing, we can be available, and I'm sure that my witnesses would be happy to be available if there was questions later on. Is that something you'd like us to do?
Senator Fischbach, I'm not sure that it will be necessary since we've all heard your bill, you may want to just to ensure that that happens, but I don't see any real concerns with Senate File 869 at this point.
Okay, thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you,
Next
Senator Fischbach and Mr. Schultz and Council Member, thank you for being here this morning.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Senator Olson, I understand you're here for Senator Hand this morning on Senate File 646. This is the Public Employee Insurance Program requiring taxes and assessments to be paid on health insurance. Senator Olson, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I'm not Senator Hand, who's the chief author of Senate File 646, but I am a co-author, and so he has asked me to stand in his stead, as he's unable to be here today. As you've indicated, this bill is regarding public units, school districts, I think in particular, but that want to join the PEEP program, which is allowed now. But if there is a move to that from the private market, that the premium taxes and the assessments for MSHA would be assessed. And Senator Hand's concern is that not in any way opposing that move, but not having it done solely for the savings, that the only savings that would be accrued would be because of those assessments. So that is the essence of the bill. There is an amendment that has been prepared. It is the A1 amendment, and I think there's a fiscal note that you have that applies to that, as well as a response regarding some expressed concern about that you may also have. But if somebody would offer that, and then the folks are here to testify and explain further the bill and their interest in it.
Thank you, Senator Michelle.
Madam Chair, I'll offer the A1, which is being handed out on behalf of Senator Olson, on behalf of Senator Hand.
Thank you.
Senator Michelle, would you like to speak to the amendment, or should we ask counsel to, or Senator Olson, do you have someone here that would like to speak to the merits of the A1 amendment?
Do you want to speak to it?
Sure. Okay. Members of the committee, my name is Catherine Kmit. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. I have not seen the latest version of the amendment language, but my understanding is that this would clarify that the bill would require the public employee insurance program to also pay the 1% HMO or 1% premium tax that is dedicated to the healthcare access fund, and also have to pay the well, I guess that's it. Thank you.
The premium tax, I believe, General. Is in statute. The other is an assessment that I don't think is dealt with in this particular section of law. The first two lines are, I think, or 1.2 is a technical correction, if I'm not mistaken. And this also, I think, reinforces if there's continuous enrollment, anyone that is in the program, PEEP program now, would be able to continue as it is. But if they did in fact move out of it and re-enter, they would be subject to this tax. That's the clarification of the amendment.
Senator Olson, I can say one of the difficulties I'm having with this bill is it seems to be a double negative or a triple negative. I'm having a hard time tracking who pays what in terms of taxes currently and what changes. So if Ms. Kmit, can you answer that question and help us understand what you're trying to accomplish here?
Certainly. Thank you, Madam Chair. And if a page could come by, I have a couple of handouts just to help illustrate this issue. As Senator Olson said, this bill deals with certain cost advantages provided by state law to the Public Employees Insurance Plan. Again, as Senator Olson said, this bill deals with certain cost advantages provided by state law to the PEEP program compared to products offered in the private market. So there are cost advantages for PEEP that make it more affordable, more competitive for school districts and local units of government to move into PEEP from the private insurance market where they are today. So just to provide some context, I'm distributing two documents. One is a pie chart that shows where Minnesotans get their health insurance coverage today, as well as a bar chart that shows how health care taxes are applied depending on the type of coverage you have. If we look at the pie chart first, you can see that this shows you where Minnesotans get their health insurance. And this data is from the Department of Health. Most Minnesotans receive their coverage through their employer, and it typically takes two forms, fully insured and self-funded. About one quarter of all Minnesotans are covered by the fully insured market. So that would be this this wedge up in the upper right corner. Self-funded coverage is regulated by the federal government and is exempt from the state insurance and health plan regulations, which include state health care taxes and assessments. And roughly 40% of Minnesotans are covered through self-funded plans. And self-funded plans are typically used by very large employers, and they typically hire local insurance companies or health plans, third-party administrators, to administer the benefits. So the employers who provide self-funded coverage have greater flexibility in determining what is covered rather than employers who purchase in the fully insured coverage. That's because this portion of the pie is regulated by the state. This portion of the pie is not. And again, one of the big advantages of being self-funded is that the cost of coverage can be less because these self-funded groups do not pay the state health care taxes or assessments, such as the MCHA assessment, which can add 2% or more to the cost of the premium. Now, the other graph that I passed out, that bar chart, just gives you a snapshot of what the tax burden is for somebody purchasing. On the left-hand side, this is an HMO product, which is governed under Chapter 62D. They pay a 1% premium tax. That's why it's a little bit less than the middle bar chart or the middle column, which is indemnity products that are governed under Chapter 62A. And then the large self-funded employers are the third column. Everybody pays the provider tax through their provider, but you can see the difference in the premium taxes and the burden that that has. So there's a real incentive then for groups that are in these segments of the market to jump out and move into the self-funded, if they can. We are seeing an increase in the number of school districts and local units of government that are seeking to move out of the private market into PEEP. One reason for this movement is because PEEP is not subject to the health care premium taxes or the MCHA assessment. So what this bill would do is require that as new groups enroll into PEEP, both the MCHA assessment and the premium tax would be collected on the premiums paid to PEEP and remitted to the collecting agencies such as the Department of Revenue. This legislation will ensure fairness across the fully insured market and the state health insurance programs as PEEP. Otherwise, as the number of lives covered by PEEP grows, there will be a negative fiscal impact to the Healthcare Access Fund, where this 1% goes. But perhaps more importantly, for small businesses that are in the fully insured market, there will be an even bigger financial burden because the cost of the MCHA assessment will fall more heavily on those individuals and smaller employers in the fully insured market. So, for example, back to the pie chart, as people jump out of this portion of the market to avoid paying taxes, jump out of the fully insured market into the self-funded market to avoid paying taxes, the MCHA assessment will still remain on this portion of the market, but this piece of the pie is going to shrink as the number of insureds declines and moves into here. So that MCHA assessment will grow more heavily on the remaining insureds who are typically individuals and small business owners who cannot afford to self-fund. I can assure you that the rising cost of coverage, because this will have an impact on their premium, will be a real issue for small employers, and shifting more of the cost will have real consequences. In fact, the Department of Health has reported that in 2009, more than 42,000 people lost small group coverage from 2 to 50 employees, bringing the total drop in small group coverage to 82,600 people since 2004. And according to an independent analysis, without this bill, if all school employees were to move out of the fully insured market, where they currently purchase private coverage, into PEEP to avoid paying those taxes, the 2011 impact shows approximately a shift of $22 to $26 million in MCHA cost from to those remaining in the fully insured market. What this bill does is require a level playing field so all the school districts and other municipalities will pay the same taxes and assessments as they were when they were in the fully insured market. And I guess if you can remember one thing about this bill is that the tax burden, particularly the MCHA assessment, does not go away. It will just build more heavily on the fully insured market, which will continue to shrink, and that will put more pressure on small businesses and individuals who purchase in the fully insured market. And as you can see from that bar chart, it's not insignificant. We're talking about 4 to 5% additional percentage points in cost. So 1 or 2, 3% will motivate groups to jump out of the fully insured market and move into PEEP.
I'm starting to follow, but I hate to ask this question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Why don't all insureds pay all those same assessments and costs? Why are they all treated so differently now, and why should we continue that?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, it's kind of the way the insurance market has grown up here in Minnesota. The indemnities have been around for a long time, and they're governed under Chapter 62A. The HMOs came about in the mid-1970s. They have their own separate chapter, and they're governed under Chapter 62D. The indemnities do not pay corporate income taxes, but in lieu of corporate income taxes, they pay a 2% premium tax. HMOs don't pay corporate taxes, although we have one HMO that does. But they pay a 1% premium tax. The tax that is collected, the 2% tax that is collected for on indemnities is goes to the general fund. The 1% tax that is collected on HMOs goes to the Healthcare Access Fund, which supports the Minnesota Care Program. It is very complicated. but that's the system we have today. What we're saying with this legislation is that we would like to see groups that are currently paying these taxes today that are seeking to jump out of the fully insured market and move into the PEEP program, we'd like to see them continue to pay that those taxes, because PEEP creates an unfair disadvantage for those. It's a state-funded program, a state pool, and it has a competitive disadvantage to the private market, and we just like to level that playing field.
Other questions, Senator Rust?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Ms. Commit. What was the public policy rationale that led to exempting PEEP from the tax? Why did we do that? What was the public policy rationale that we're now, with this bill, going to increase their taxes? And also, who's going to bear the burden here of the increased tax? But originally, I think it's getting to what Chairwoman wanted to know, too. How did we get here? What was the public policy rationale that exempted them?
Madam Chair and Senator Rest, I believe the public policy rationale was to provide an additional option to local units of government, school districts that, for whatever reason, either had trouble finding coverage in the private market or wanted to do something else. So PEEP was created. It's a very small program. It has about 5,600 people covered today, so it's not a very big pool at all. I know there's somebody here from MMB who could speak more directly to the why PEEP was created. And then who would pay? It would be exactly who's paying today. So a local unit of government or school district that purchases coverage in the private market today pays the cost of coverage, which includes these premium taxes and assessments. So if they were to move into PEEP, they would continue to pay those premium taxes and assessments.
So, Madam Chair.
Senator Rust.
So is one of the purposes of this bill to discourage local governments from leaving the fully insured market?
Madam Chair and Senator Rest, we are concerned that there is an unfair advantage for some groups to seek to move into the PEEP program as a way to avoid paying the state taxes that small businesses and individuals cannot do. They're not able to move into the PEEP program, and that seems like an unfair situation. So this would just make that fair, so that they are not, that the state government is not incentivizing groups to move into a government program out of the private market.
Chair, Ms. Commit,
so
one of the purposes here is to discourage them from going into the PEEP program, because there would be no advantage anymore to have lower costs insurance for their employees.
Madam Chair and Senator Rest, that certainly would change the calculus for them in making a decision about whether or not to move into PEEP. However, they may have other reasons why they would want to move into PEEP.
Madam Chair, so Ms. Commit, what other than the, and maybe somebody from local governments or MMB can answer this, but are there other advantages to being in PEEP from a local government's point of view, that even if this passes and they do get a tax increase, that they would still stay there, or would the program fold? And also, when did it start?
Madam Chair and Senator Rest, I'm sorry, I don't know the answer to when the PEEP program actually started. And again, there's somebody here from MMB who might be able to answer that question. And so just that so I understand your first question, if this bill were to pass, would PEEP fold? Was that your question? I don't believe that I don't think it would affect PEEP or cause PEEP to fold. Let me also just state that groups that are currently covered in PEEP would be grandfathered in, and so they wouldn't have this would not be a retroactive kind of thing. but for groups that are moving into PEEP, in large part to avoid paying those state taxes and assessments, might think twice about that.
And one final question. And where does CGIP fit into all this? What do they pay on this stuff?
Madam Chair and Senator Rest, CGIP, and we do have someone here from CGIP who could speak directly to this. I can assure you that CGIP does not pay the MCHA assessment. So CGIP, which is the State Employee Group Insurance Plan, which covers all state employees and their dependents as well as all of you, does not pay the MCHA assessment. So that assessment falls disproportionately on those in the fully insured market.
So does CGIP pay this premium tax that you're proposing PEEP pay?
Madam Chair and Senator Rest, I believe that CGIP does not pay the premium tax either because CGIP is a self-funded plan.
So, Madam Chair, if we're talking about a level playing field, why, Senator Olson, why doesn't this proposal include CGIP?
Madam Chair and Senator Rest, if I could, we would be fine with having this apply to CGIP. However, if that really is a bigger discussion, and if that were to be added to this bill, it would create a fiscal note because then you'd have to appropriate more money to pay the cost of participating in MCHA and the other premium taxes.
There's a revenue estimate now. They're not? Just add to that.
And Senator Olson, I'm having a hard time understanding this bill. I think it's unusual contortions to try and accomplish an outcome. And what I'm hearing, and please tell me this is not correct, that once somebody pays an assessment in taxation, that burden goes with them no matter what choices they make. So then we're taking out the incentive to make a tax avoidance decision, which we do all, we encourage that here in the tax committee, that you minimize your tax burden. And so we want to continue to encourage people to minimize their tax burden. And it sounds to me like what you're saying is you're attaching the tax burden to the taxpayer and saying no matter what choice you make, you carry this burden with you because it's good for the state of Minnesota. I hope you can tell me that I am wrong.
Well, Madam Chair, let me interject my ignorance into this. In the first place, the 1987 is when this was, in fact, created as
a... So this is, to provide Chair, this is not a new program.
Pardon me?
PEEP is not a new program.
No, so Madam Chair and Senator Resta, it is not new. It was 1987 that it was created to provide public employees and other eligible persons with medical and dental benefit coverage. I'm not sure what year the MSHA assessments went into place because I think that has been during my tenure here. It might have been after that. Trying to find a way to provide coverage for those that weren't covered, and I think the reality is our public employees are generally covered uniformly, regardless of the pre-existing conditions now in the insurance that they acquire by either route. If they were to participate in the PEEP as well, that is not necessarily the motive for change. I think the issue is if the move to PEEP is only for the purpose of the tax avoidance, that it is challenging what we have, as a legislature, have created as a means for trying to fund those with that are unable to acquire insurance on the private market. And that's another issue that's not being dealt with, but I think it's an issue being raised that if we, in fact, are seeing an effort to move a lot of people in, there aren't a lot there now, but there appears to be an effort going forward to move a lot of the public employees into the PEEP program, and this is the primary advantage. It shifts the burden, but I think it also probably will lead to more uninsured in another segment that we're going to be back here trying to grapple with. And this was kind of a stopgap hold to have people think twice before they make that move if it's just for that avoidance. So, Senator, Madam Chair, you may not like that, but we have done stranger things in this body for many years.
Madam Chair. Very true, Senator Olson, Senator Ross.
Thank you. Well, you know, it is informative that this program has been around for decades, and I would have thought would have been, you know, thoroughly vetted for any kind of unintended consequences or level playing fields or whatever, but here it is 24 years after it starts, and all of a sudden, looks like, we're concerned about an advantage that the PEAT program has. I mean, has this bill been introduced every year since PEAT started and the current system got into place, or is it, or what? Struggling here.
Madam Chair, Senator Rest, not to my knowledge, and it wasn't my bill introduction. I just agreed to co-author it with Senator Hand. So you'd have to ask him that question. I'm not sure. I think it is triggered by a particular promotional move that could have a very major effect on this. And it's not intended to affect those that are in it and stay continuously in the PEAT program that are in it now. It's just for new entrants.
Madam Chair and Senator Rest, I think we're beginning to see more and more movement from the private market into the PEAT market because of the cost advantages. When PEAT was created back in the 80s, the cost of health insurance was a lot less, and more groups were in the private market. As the cost of health insurance has grown, groups get more and more interested in trying to figure out ways to reduce their costs, and so particularly for some units of local government, including school districts, they have been seeking to move into PEAP because of the tax differential, and as a result, it can actually cost them less than what they would be paying in the private market.
Chair.
Senator Pogemiller.
Is there also a possibility that there's some coverage differences? Quality of the product?
Mr. Chair and Senator Pogemiller, I would say generally no, and the reason is in the fully insured market, this segment of the pie is regulated by the state. All the state mandates apply, all the benefit mandates, coverage mandates, provider mandates apply. So it's a pretty robust set of benefits that have to be offered under those products. People who move into PEAP typically follows a similar model of benefits, similar product of benefits, because the state, like the CGIP program, follows pretty closely what is required in the private market. It's the tax differential, really, that makes a difference.
Senator Pogemiller.
And on this pie chart, where's CGIP and where's PEAP on the pie chart?
Mr. Chair and Senator Pogemiller, they would be in here in the self-funded market.
Senator Olson, we've got a few other folks who've asked to testify. Maybe we should take that at this point.
Ms. Bodine.
Could you welcome the committee and state your name for the record, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Lisa Bodine with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, and I'm here today representing our membership. It's approximately 2,600 businesses throughout the state of Minnesota. Generally speaking, 70% of our members fall into that small group insurance market under 50 employees. The Chamber supports Senate File 646, and as Ms. Kmit's testimony spoke to, many of her comments I will reiterate just in terms of the importance to the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. The MCHA assessment really is paid currently by the fully fully insured market in the state of Minnesota, which, as Ms. Kmit mentioned, is made up of small businesses and individual policyholders for the most part. And according to the state and federal laws, public programs and the self-insured groups are not required to pay these taxes and assessments. So, again, as that fully insured market shrinks, those businesses and individual policyholders are bearing the burden of that MCHA assessment as it continues to grow. And as you may have heard me testify in other committees, the fully insured market currently represents only 25% of the total market, as you've seen from the pie chart. That is a number that has consistently declined in the past 10 years at an average rate of 1% per year. And as you can imagine, businesses are exiting the small group market. Insurance is a retention and recruitment tool for businesses. They want to offer insurance and want to have healthy employees. Healthy employees equal healthy business. This is a huge issue for Minnesota Chamber of Commerce members. As more people move to PEEP without paying those assessments, it will drive up the cost for health insurance for our members. The rising cost of health care is one of the primary businesses, a primary challenge for small businesses today. And we also believe, in addition, you know, when the state exempts itself from these types of taxes, which it would be doing, moving the public employees as the law would currently allow them to do, as they exempt themselves from these taxes, we believe it creates an unlevel playing field for that fully insured market. We believe it also divorces the state from feeling the burden of the increase and pressure that's placed on the private sector for these types of situations. We believe that we support Senate File 646 and encourage your support as well. Please let me know if you have any questions. We thank Senator Olson today for presenting this bill.
Thank you, Ms.
And Madam Chair?
Senator Olson, she gave me
Mr.
the gavel.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, the gavel didn't move.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, the amendment that the current chair has offered does reduce that premium tax charge to the PEEP from 2% to 1% rather than leaving it at the 2. So that is what the amendment does, too. Should clarify that.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I need some clarity. I've listened a couple times now to people talking about how local units of government are going to move from a health insurance plan that currently pays this charge to this PEEP that doesn't. But from my perspective, most of these public employees, teachers, in my neck of the woods aren't paying it right now because they're in one of these 8 service co-ops. And I've always been a strong supporter of these service co-ops because I think they're doing a good job. But to argue that those employees shouldn't move to PEEP because they then won't be paying this charge isn't accurate because they're currently not paying it because the service co-ops are exempt. And if you look at the Minnesota Department of Revenue estimate, about two-thirds of the way down on the front page, they currently are exempt and they will continue to be exempt from this charge. So it doesn't, the argument is not holding up about that point of this. Now, there might be other reasons for not having these people move into PEEP, and I have voted against that on the floor of the Senate in the past, but I don't think that the reason that is being presented to the committee today is accurate.
Senator Skoy, are you looking at the May 3rd revenue estimate?
Yeah, Madam Chair, the May 3rd, it just was handed out.
There were 3. I just want to clarify for folks that are following along here. We're looking at the May 3rd, and you're on the back page or the front page?
The front page, about two-thirds of the way down. It says there are 8 service cooperatives that operate self-funded pools that provide insurance coverage to local units of government. These self-funded pools would continue to be exempt from the gross premium tax. Also, the self-funded pools would continue to be exempt from the MCHA assessment. These are the pools that are providing the current insurance for these people that are proposing to move to PEEP. So they currently aren't paying this charge that is getting so much discussion here in committee today.
Ms. Kmit?
Madam Chair and members, this bill wouldn't do anything to the service cooperatives, but there are local units of government that purchase coverage for their employees through a variety of different ways. Some do it through the service co-ops, some self-insure because they're large enough to do that, and some purchase through the private insurance market. Those that purchase coverage through the private insurance market today pay those taxes and assessments. They are now being incented to move out of the private insurance market into PEEP to avoid paying those taxes. And this bill would simply say, if you're a local unit of government and you want to move out of the private market into PEEP, those taxes and assessments will continue to apply.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm not naive enough to not understand what's going on here. I've been around the last couple of years where this proposal has been to move some of the teacher employees into PEEP. I mean, that's what the proposal that we've been both voting on the last number of years, and I haven't supported it because I've thought that it was going to hurt the ability of our service co-ops to provide insurance to cities and counties as well as schools. But to change the tax structure because of the MSHA assessment and the gross premium tax that those employees currently aren't paying because the service co-ops are exempt is not a valid argument. Now, you can make other arguments for this, but the one that you're making today isn't valid.
Well, Madam Chair, and Senator Skoy, I think for the same reasons that you have expressed, is probably part of I shouldn't put words into Senator Hand's mouth, but to incent people to move away from the service co-ops and what they are doing would also be an impact of other moves. And therefore, this is put in place to try to prevent that flow as well, because that could well be a part of it. And it's... the move to just the 1% gross premium tax is not making it that egregious, but nonetheless, to not have that be the only reason for people moving into the public pool.
Madam Chair, I think Senator Olson, you're getting to the heart of the matter. Mm-hmm.
Senator Pogue-Miller, and then Senator Huff, and then Senator Michelle. Senator Pogue-Miller, Senator Howe, and then we're going to hear from Ms. Buhig from Education Minnesota.
Ms. Pitt, who else is in that this pie chart, this part of the pie chart?
Madam Chair and Senator Pogue-Miller, that's typically made up of large corporations, large employers.
Target 3M.
Absolutely. General Mills.
General Mills. And why are they exempt from the MSHA tax?
Madam Chair and Senator Pogue-Miller, they are exempt because these are large corporations that typically have employees in multiple states, and under the 1974 Federal ERISA Act, they are exempt from following state laws and statutes relative to benefit mandates and that sort of thing. So they're exempt from state regulations, state taxes, because they have the federal ERISA covers them and exempts them from state laws. That way they don't have to follow 50 different state insurance schemes, and that's why they're covered.
That's why the law was passed.
And that's why the law was passed. That's right.
Mm-hmm. And Madam Chair, and why do large employers self-insure?
Madam Chair and Senator Pogue-Miller, large employers self-insure in large part because they can. They have the resources, so they act as their own insurance company. They pay the claims themselves for the cost of coverage for their employees. However, most large employers are not insurance companies. They produce cereal or they sell goods in the market or something else. Therefore, they typically hire a health plan or another insurance company or another third-party administrator to administer the benefits and process the claims and staff the call centers and things like that.
So someone like Blue Cross Blue Shield is kind of in both of these pieces in some respects.
Madam Chair and Senator Pogue-Miller, yes. The health plans serve as insurers, where the risk is transferred from the organization, from the employer, directly to the insurance company. But they also have some business where they provide third-party administrator services to large employers.
So isn't there kind of an issue of which playing field we're trying to even here? And it does seem like you could have a different perspective on which playing field should be even.
Madam Chair and Senator Pogue-Miller, I mean, ideally, if we could spread all of the taxes to those who are covered in the self-funded market. That would certainly make it more fair, but we can't do that because of federal ERISA.
Senator Skoy?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Kind of to follow along on what Senator Pogermiller was talking about, when these people that self-insure generally purchase reinsurance, do they pay any of these fees on the reinsurance? Because when I was on the county board again, Clearwater County self-insured because we could save money. And that's what this is all about. But we had to purchase reinsurance for everything over, I don't remember what it was, $300,000 or whatever the one was. Do they pay the MCHA and whatever that other fee is on the gross premiums tax on the reinsurance then that they purchased? Because they all... they don't totally self-insure. They just self-insure on the small stuff.
Madam Chair, could counsel, Senate counsel maybe has, would you have any idea of insurance law to that point of trying to rescue someone who may not have the answer to
or that? Madam Chair, we'd have to look at the statute to see under 62E, which regulates MCHA, to see if they are, in fact, defined as a contributing member. I'll make a guess here that I believe they are not. So I believe they don't pay that.
Thank you. We do have another testifier, Ms. Alzweiger from Education Minnesota. Oh, I'm sorry. Before we do that, Senator Howe, do you have a question for one of the testifiers?
Yeah, I do. I do have a question that maybe they can respond to. And I guess I have a letter here from... seventh grade science teacher who serves on a district insurance committee meeting, and they're meeting this afternoon to talk about how they can, you know, keep the health care of all employees, maintain high quality coverage, and of course keep the premium increases to a minimum. And they're looking at PEEP as maybe a way that they might do it for the 2012 renewal. And I guess my concern, regardless of whether or not I would support this legislation, has to do with the effective date, because it's kind of blindsiding groups to make this change, and I don't think it's giving much transparency to the issue. I think at least the effective date, if you want to reshuffle the deck and you want to say these are the new set of rules we're going to play by, most of these people are into contracts now, and this effective date needs to be out far enough that they need to have the opportunity. We shouldn't try and trap them like getting trapped into a bad cell phone contract. You should at least see what's coming. You should know what the date is, and there should be ample time to make the changes prior to saying, too bad you didn't do it ahead of time. So that would be my comment on the effective date. Any thoughts?
Ms. Kmit or Senator Olson?
Madam Chair, I don't in particular on that. I think that if the intent is as we've tried to explain, you probably wouldn't want to do that. But interestingly, if you read some of the statements about what the performance or the requests for quotes from PEEP have been, generally the number of requests have not been, the ones that have followed through have been a significantly smaller portion than have been the ones who requested quotes through the years. So it's right now there doesn't happen to be a flood in that direction. But I think there's some concern in anticipation of that this change would be in order to not have that be the sole reason.
Madam Chair, just a response. But I would say that we should signal to them, not just say, well, we're going to infect this, and they're trapped currently. We're just going to prevent any movement, or we're going to you're trapped where you are today. There should be a signaling and and you're right, it may cause a flood, it may reshuffle the deck, but I think that is being up front. It's showing some transparency, and it's at least signaling the change of direction of how we're going to handle things, and it's not going to blindside certain groups. And I think it's a proper way to at least put that effective date out so people have an opportunity to make decisions.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, that is a legislative decision.
And Madam Chair, I would just say to Senator Howell, we would be happy to talk with you more about that.
All right. Ms. Altweiler, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jan Altweiler, Education, Minnesota, and I actually have said to Senator Hahn in a previous committee, thank you for bringing this bill forward, because it gives us the opportunity to talk about what is really happening out there with health insurance in school districts and the options that are available, and actually the lack of competition that we have had. And Senator Skoy, you're exactly right about what your comments. Why is this happening? For those of you who are new to the legislature, Education Minnesota has tried for about 8 years or so to get a statewide mandatory health insurance pool for school employees, and it didn't happen. And Democrats, Republicans, many said it should be voluntary, it should be competitive. So Education Minnesota, knowing that we weren't going to get a statewide health insurance pool passed, we followed our legal options to try to seek bids from PEEP. PEEP is a different plan than it was a few years ago. It is now modeled after the state plan. It is a very good plan that leverages the numbers for drug prices, drug costs, and everything. When we informed our members of about 340 school districts about an option to go to PEEP in the contract negotiations year, which is this year, 220 or more school districts said, yes, we want that option, because the employees have the right to seek the bid. They got initial numbers. The next round, then, they had to come up with a tentative yes. We now have 170 school districts that want a competitive, voluntary bid from PEEP. Why is this bill here? Because it would create an unlevel playing field. You saw the chart. The bottom pie piece said self-insured. The new enrollees into PEEP would be the only ones in the self-insured in Minnesota that would have to pay MCHA and premium tax, approximately a 4% increase. You talk about competition, you are now making the playing field unlevel, because compared to the service co-ops who do not have to pay MCHA and premium taxes, the school employees that go into PEEP would have a 4% approximately higher rate because of that. I want to tell you how successful PEEP has been. In Alexandria, which was the first district that went in 2008, they have seen savings every year over what the other employees in Alexandria have had. When they first joined the PEEP pool in 2009, they saw 1% decrease in premiums, and they will have a 2% decrease in premiums this year. Moose Lake tried to move into the PEEP pool in 2009. The superintendent is on the service co-op board of directors and is on the service co-op insurance committee. The superintendent refused to go with the Moose Lake teachers to make the switch, and the teachers have seen huge increases in premiums with the service co-ops, as much as 30% in 1 year. The teachers took a slight increase of 8% to go into PEEP, and now their next premium change is a 23% decrease in premiums, through PEEP. Duluth, we have a similar story. There's a change in benefits, but overall they're saving $1.7 million. They reduced their benefit structure. They are contributing additional money to HSA. That is nearly the fiscal note, a $1.7 million savings over what they were projected to pay through Health Partners. So that's some of the history. Do we think it is right to put two taxes on a group of individuals who have been hit so hard with insurance premiums that people can have a tough time, some of them staying in the profession. We have 6 school districts that no longer have health insurance. I hear the chamber talking about attracting, retaining people into businesses. Let's talk about school employees. We don't understand how this could be supported when it treats the same group of employees differently. If you want Education Minnesota to offer a solution, which is, and I say this a little bit in jest, is let's put this tax on all school district employees. Now, we don't want that to happen. But why should the people in the service co-ops be treated differently than the people who are trying to actually make some positive, voluntary, competitive change to get decent premiums? So we'd ask that you not support this bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Thank you, Ms. Oswager. I just want to let the committee know we do have other items on the agenda for today, and this is a difficult issue for us. We may want to take additional testimony on this, Senator Olson, and give it further consideration. We want to take back up Senator Jungbauer's bill. He's got an amendment. And we also have Senator Chamberlain's bill, and there are a couple other technical bills today.
Madam Chair, would you consider adding the amendment to make it the way the author wanted it?
I am going to defer to Senator Michelle, who offered the amendment, as to how he would like to proceed here.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Senator Olson. I agree. We're going to hit the clock here. So I think what would be best, and I appreciate Senator Olson, you've been putting in the pilot seat after starting off as a co-pilot without Senator Hahn. But I think I'll withdraw the A1, Madam Chair, and then ask the committee to let's lay 646 on the table and then have allow for a little more discussion and, again, to engage Senator Hahn and others who've been working on this. I think that'd be helpful and probably the best thing to do with your agenda this morning.
Thank you, Senator Michelle. The motion to lay this bill on the table is not debatable. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed say no. Senate House Bill 46 is on the table, Senator.
Thank
Olson,
you, Madam
we
Chair,
can hear
members.
It again after we've addressed some of the concerns. I would like to take up Senator Chamberlain's bill at this point, and just my luck, Senator Chamberlain is ill this morning, and as a co-author, I'm going to pinch hit for Senator Chamberlain. I hope you'll all be kind to me. And I am going to move, and Senator Michelle has agreed to move.
Senator Ortman to Senate File 652.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senator Chamberlain has been working on a tax amnesty bill, and it is something that I suggested that he consider this year. I want to talk about the merits of perhaps switching from what is a very heavy audit compliance model to what some other states have done, which is amnesty as an alternative. Amnesty being a model where we incentivize taxpayers to come in and pay tax indebtedness and liabilities with reduced penalties, as opposed to what I think has become a model of over-auditing. And I've got some handouts that are being handed out here that will support what I'm saying here about this model of what I think is over-auditing. I think we should be considering the alternative. Members, the governor's budget had recommended a compliance initiative for the next biennium of $4.9 million. It's not included in our state Senate government bill, and it's not in the House bill. I have a handout for you that would show you that we've had 7 initiatives for audit compliance since 2002. The return on investment originally, when done, was estimated to be 1 for 10. Now we're talking about 1 to 4, meaning $4 for every $1 of investment. We've had 711 new hires in audit compliance in the Department of Revenue since 2002. It is one of the fastest growing departments in the state of Minnesota, all directed at audit compliance and capturing revenue out of taxpayers. I'm concerned that there's too much audit activity and not enough working with taxpayers who are building and driving our economy. Amnesty is another option to consider, and I'm hoping that we will consider the right timing for when perhaps we should be moving from this audit compliance model to more of an amnesty model. There are several testifiers here, or at least 2 testifiers here today. I didn't bring my agenda with me, but I know my good friend Scott Radin from the Johnson Group in St. Cloud, and he is here to testify to just give you a picture of what's happening with some of our employers and businesses in the state of Minnesota when they face auditing by the Department of Revenue, so you can hear what I have about their experience. Mr. Radin.
Well, all right, thank you.
Welcome to the committee, sir. Just state your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Scott Radin, and I own the Johnson Group Marketing. It's an advertising agency out of St. Cloud. My wife and I have owned the agency for 16 years. And the reason I keep looking down, in the interest of not rambling, I tried to write down some key points to keep it moving. As an advertising agency, we're a service business. Sales tax is simply a pass-through cost for us. We do stuff for our clients. The vendor charges us tax. We charge the client. They pay us. We pay the vendor. When I was audited 3 years ago on a sales tax audit, I made what I consider to be a major mistake. The auditor concluded that I owed approximately $2,700. While her findings were incorrect as we reviewed the audit report, my accountant and I both agreed that it would cost me less to pay the $2,700 than to use my time and pay my accountant's time to go through the process of proving her findings inaccurate. As with most service business, we make most of our money on billable hours, very similar to accountants and attorneys. With this last audit that we're currently in right now, so far off with a grand total of $28,000 in sales tax owed, I had no choice but to spend non-billable time as well as pay my accountant $150 an hour to show the inaccuracies. During the audit, the young lady that was sent to my accountant's office to do the audit, my accountant stopped in twice to ask if she needed any clarification or explanation, and she refused any assistance. So far on this second audit, I am estimating I'm about $6,000 into finding all the inaccuracies within the report. When we got a letter from the auditor, Angela, I won't read the whole thing. She basically says, this report serves as notice that if no information is provided by Monday, February 7th, 2011, the enclosed report will be issued to the Commissioner of Revenue and you will have full appeal rights. If you decide to appeal, please follow the appeal instructions enclosed within this order. So we set up a meeting with her because obviously I wanted to go over this and point out that seriously about 95% of it is wrong. On February 7th at 7:30 in the morning at my accountant's office, I was there, non-billable time. My accountant was there at $150 an hour. The auditor didn't show up. So we still have not talked to the young lady regarding this particular finding. The frustration and anger in this particular situation comes into play when you look at the report. I didn't give everybody a copy of it because, well, it's 26 pages, and that'd be over a ream of paper I'd have to carry up here. So it's 26 pages. It's very hard to decipher. But when I went through it, and I'm not an accountant, but even as I'm looking through some of the stuff, I'm like, that's not right. That's not right. And so I'm looking at items that I know are wrong. Then as I sit down with my accountant and we dig further into it, I discover that almost all of it is wrong, and all the documentation to prove that it's not correct is in the very large box of information I was required to provide her for the audit. The impression I got from her letter was that she just wanted to file the claim and have us appeal it. Okay, but again, that's more time and money on my part. I'm going to give you just a quick rundown, and if you have questions, stop me, on some of the findings. I think you'll find them to be very basic, but I brought with portions of the report. You can take a look at the full report if you'd like, but I'm going to run down some of the inaccuracies and why this is so frustrating to have to prove that, no, we don't actually owe this money. So if you look, I think everybody got two copies. One is of the report and one is of some corresponding invoices. On this particular page, she's talking about a lawnmower for $1,177, as she's showing as a taxable amount. The lawnmower is actually a snowblower. Anybody could make that mistake. But as you can see from the first invoice, I paid, our agency is in a house, by the way. We have to have a snowblower to clean off the driveway or the parking lot and the sidewalk. I paid $1,099.99 for the snowblower, $76 in tax for $1,176.99. Over here, she has that exact invoice listed as $1,177. I get the rounding up. But it clearly states that $76 in tax was paid on this particular item. Then, in several instances, she listed the color printer, which, by the way, going back and finding out exactly what numbers she's doing because she's not quoting any invoices is quite time-consuming. This is my lease with a business company in St. Cloud for my color printer upstairs. As you can see on there, again, there's usage and there's sales and use tax. And then also for the extra copies, there's sales and use tax. That number corresponds with the 290 that she listed as a total number. Again, incorrect, because we've already paid 18.10 and 14 cents of sales tax to Marco for this. Moving forward. If you go to number three, fees. She's listing as a taxable. We're a service industry. Our fees are not taxable. As I questioned this with my accountant, he had even said, you know, there's sometimes where if you're doing a business card for somebody, you know, when you do the production of that card, that particular time slot could be taxable, at which point I say that's great. We just got done doing a business card presentation for some attorneys, and we gave them 38 options. From there, they narrowed it down to 10. From there, they narrowed it down to 4. From there, they narrowed it down to 2. After they picked one, the amount of time invested in that client is minimal, minutes, 15, 20 minutes tops. All of the big time is presenting 38 options to them. So at what time am I supposed to start saying I'm going to charge you sales tax on this, and how am I supposed to monitor that? A couple of them, you see where all the little hash marks are? Those are all hospitals. A big chunk of what she found in her finding were hospitals. And what you have here is all the certificates of exemptions from all the hospitals that I pulled right out of the documents that she had. The next one on there would be number 4. And again, I think if she would have asked for assistance, we could have cleared this up before putting this huge report together. This one, it's number 4 down there, where it says Gold Delta Sky Miles card. I use a credit card to pay some advertising invoices for our clients. Again, the invoices are here. This is advertising. It's not a taxable item, but it was. You can clearly see what it was for, the client it was for, who it was for, and the amount. But again, she listed those amounts as us owing tax for the advertising items. Going forward to the last part, and this was a biggie, sales tax collected and not remitted. And again, I can understand where she would be confused on this. The frustration is that she doesn't ask for clarification on it. I grabbed one number because there's so many here, and trying to find the invoices would be almost impossible. The $514.10 one that she shows is sales tax collected and not remitted. With our agency, the invoice that you see corresponding, and I blocked out the who it was for because that had no bearing on this, but you can see how the invoice is laid out. There's agency fees, then there's printing. And we always break out our printing, and in this case, shipping, because printing is a taxable item. So we show our fees. We did the printing for their catalogs. We did some color prints, which is also taxable, and then some advertising, which is not. And on the bottom of our invoice, you can see that we charged our client $514.10 in sales tax, of which they paid. The next invoice beyond that is the cost for the printing. So if you take the printing there of $7,134, add in the freight of $136, you will get $7,270, which is the number we've listed on our printing. The tax, the $508.90, combined with the tax of the color print, came up to $514.10. The client pays us. When we pay the invoice for printing, we pay $7,778.90. So again, it's a pass-through. We charge the client. We pay the vendor pays the sales tax. We're not technically collecting sales tax. We are charging for it because our clients owe it on printing, but we don't collect it or pay it in. And then the last one is just simply an example, again, of an invoice where you can see the 1,500 envelopes for $210. The corresponding invoice is 1,500 envelopes for $210 plus $1,444 in tax, and we paid the $224.44. So what I've got here is literally, well, I'll go hundreds, I'm not going to go thousands, of examples where I'm now going to have to go through and prove to her that she's wrong on almost every single one of these claims. And that's where the frustration, and that's where it's costing me money. I'm no longer running my business. I'm trying to dispel somebody that put this together in one day without asking me any questions, not having any knowledge of what I do. I would assume she would know that hospitals are tax exempt, but even if she didn't, we had the documentation to show her that hospitals were tax exempt. And so this is, and as I explained to Senator Ortman, this is where my frustration comes in. It just seems like she just wants to file this and then come back and have us appeal it. And again, if I'm not billing my hours, I am not making any money at all. The only thing I'm doing right now is not making money and paying my accountant $150 an hour to prove that this 26-page report is 95% wrong. So thank you for your time. If anybody has any questions, I'd be happy to answer anything.
Thank you, Mr. Radin. Senator Ortman, we also have Terry Steenblock from the department on this measure. So, Mr. Radin, stay with us here.
You bet.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, for the record, my name is Terry Steenblock, and I'm the Assistant Commissioner of Individual Taxes for the Department of Revenue. One of the things that I wanted to talk about was in reference to amnesty, and I did have a PowerPoint that I provided. But before I do that, I would like to apologize on behalf of the Department of Revenue for the experience that you've had. I did get copies.
Having. Thank you.
Thank you. I did get copies of the handouts that you provided, and I'll give you my business card, and we can visit.
Okay, thank you.
Situation. Okay, thank you very much for bringing it forward.
Ms. Steenblock, thank you.
I did have a PowerPoint that wanted to talk a little bit about some of the experiences and backgrounds that we've had in reference to the amnesty legislation that's being proposed and some of the experiences we've had previously. Wanted to talk a little bit about some historical information with you. As you look at the PowerPoint that we've handed out, you will notice that we talk a little bit about during the 2003 legislative session, there was legislation created that was called Advanced Collection Program. We referenced it as ACP. For this particular program, it was considered kind of a modern approach to collections. It was a way for us to collect outstanding accounts receivable that otherwise would not have been collected. So in a sense, it was kind of an amnesty program. I wanted to share a little bit of the high-level requirements with this particular program. The legislation did have some standards that were set within this program, and it was to apply only to debts that were more than 2 years old on the date of enactment. For obligations that were more than 4 years old on the date of enactment, we could offer a reduction or discount up to 50%. And we did offer a reduction of 50%. We went up to the maximum because the statute did talk about making sure that we maximized the impact of this particular program. For obligations that were more 4 years old or more on the date of enactment, oh, I already touched on that. I'm sorry. Let me move on. For obligations that were more than 2 years old and less than 4 years old, we were allowed to use a percentage up to 35%, and in that particular case, we did use 35%. The program ran from October through December of 2004, and at that time, the collection division had identified 13,500 debtors who met the criteria for participation in this particular program. The accounts receivable that was attached to that, if every one of those debtors had participated in that program, the potential revenue that could have been collected was $79.5 million. The collection division did send out notifications to all 13,500 who qualified for the program, inviting them to participate in the program. There were 512 taxpayers who did take advantage of that particular program, and the dollars collected from the advanced collection program was $850,000.
some of the things that we would like to consider or ask that you consider as we move forward with the proposed legislation is things that by offering a discount, we're not able to utilize all the collection tools and efforts that we have available to us. We are one of the states that has a large amount of collection tools and a large amount of information that is available to us, which does allow us to collect more and to bring more people into compliance than what some other states have as experiences. The way the legislation is currently written, many of the debts that are currently on enforced collection actions, and that means things that either we're already in the process of collecting those by using some of those collection tools, or the people are proactively coming forward to set up a payment plan. The way the legislation is currently written, they would not be excluded. So we would lose some of the revenue. We would be able to gain the revenue long term if we were able to continue with our efforts, but we would lose some of that revenue up front if this program were to be implemented. We also run the risk of jeopardizing future compliance. For taxpayers who are compliant, sometimes they wonder, why should I remain compliant? And for those that are not compliant, they look for opportunities of when a program will come along again in the future. When the last ACP program was implemented, there were a lot of tools that the department did not have at our discretion to utilize to help us collect debts at that time. And those were things such as liquor posting, license clearance, personal officer liability assessments, the offset programs such as the federal offset and offsetting with Wisconsin, and the financial institution data match. So we have implemented all these tools since this program was made available, and they have added significant value to our ability to collect debts. As you may know, there was also a tax amnesty program that was done. That was done back in October of 1984. The program ran from August and through October. And at that particular time, the total dollars collected was $12.1 million. However, all the taxing divisions did not have some of the tools that we currently have available to us today as well. So some of the things such as the automated commissioner file returns process, compliance tools such as license clearance, which we use on the non-filer side, robust information with the non-filers. We didn't have a lot of the partnerships that we have with other states or with the federal government that allow us, provide us with audit lead information. We did not have a data warehouse at that time, which provides us with information and sources to use for collecting and auditing taxpayers. And we did not have the number of auditors and collectors that we currently have today, which helps in the area of compliance. We did do some research with some of the other states to find out what worked and what wasn't working in reference to amnesty. And one of the things that we did hear reoccurring was that in order for a program to be successful, you do need to provide advertising. And states do many different things. Some do commercials, radio announcements, some do mailouts. But we would need to do some type of advertising campaign along with this, which would have a cost associated with it. We would run the risk of resources that are currently focused on compliance efforts would need to be reallocated to administering the amnesty program. So, for example, the collection division within the Department of Revenue collects debts for other state agencies. The efforts that go towards collecting those debts of other state agencies also includes a revenue tag of when debts are referred to the Department of Revenue, there is a collection cost that's added to that, and when the debt is collected, the collection cost funds go into the general fund. If we were to administer an amnesty program, those people that are working on collecting those debts would need to be reallocated to administering the amnesty program. So there would be some direct compliance losses to both the tax and the non-tax debt that is processed through the agency. We did also explore the option of outsourcing to see what would be included in that particular functionality. And in visiting with Louisiana, we did discover that they did outsource it, and the cost for them to outsource it was $5 million. So if we did end up outsourcing something along these lines, there would be a cost associated with that as well. Some other things that we'd like for you to consider is that there is the potential to lose additional revenue when administering an amnesty program. In visiting with the other states that have administered the program, I have captured here some of the additional revenue losses that they've incurred as a result of the amnesty program. There have been write-offs of penalties and fees totaling $70.2 million. So again, if we administer an amnesty program, we may not have the opportunity to collect these debts and the penalties and interests that are associated with them. Abatements of interest totaling $1.3 million and accounts receivable write-off of $20 million. And all of the agencies talked about the impacts to future years of accounts receivable as well. Minnesota, as Senator Ortman has mentioned, has already invested in increased compliance efforts. And from a compliance standpoint, we're pretty progressive and have a larger amount of collectors and auditors than some of the states that are administering an amnesty program. And because of that, we don't know that there would be the potential revenue generated here that other states have experienced. We do already have the authority to conduct voluntary disclosure and compliance efforts. And what that is say, for example, a sales tax business hasn't registered within the state. They're off our radar. They can come forward and work with us. They can come forward anonymously in the beginning and work with us to come into compliance. And the outcome of that may be a reduction in penalty. There is negotiations that occur, and again, the outcome may be a reduction in penalties. So we do have that discretion to do that as needed, as where it makes sense from the business standpoint and for the state of Minnesota as a whole. We are concerned that amnesty would have a negative impact on the projected revenue generation and for baseline and initiative production goals that are there. And then finally, again, as I mentioned earlier, voluntary compliance would be jeopardized. So with that, again, we appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today, and I would be open to any questions.
Thank you. I have Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Ortman, I think it's really good that you're bringing this issue forward, because I think this idea that we can just continue to hire auditors and get more money for the state is gone way beyond where it should, and we're driving Minnesota businesses crazy. An amnesty doesn't help your testifier, though. He didn't do anything wrong. There's nothing to give him amnesty from. It's just the process that we've set up that we audit and then have the business appeal. And, you know, Minnesota businesses mostly are trying to do a pretty good job as they collect revenue for the state. I mean, they're our collection agency for sales taxes. And we've got this complicated system. If you're a convenience store, you've got a lot of items that are taxable and some that aren't taxable. And if you happen to miss one, you're subject to fines and penalties and interest on that missed portion. But if you happen to charge tax on one that shouldn't be taxed, well, then that's just okay. And the complexity goes to like a candy bar. If you got a Hershey's bar, it's taxable, because there's no flour in it. But if you got a Trix bar or a Kix bar with a little flour wafer in it, it's not taxable. So what's the convenience store owner supposed to do? He can't possibly set up such fine divisions in his cash register system. So, you know, we've really got this sales tax stuff way too complicated. And we're going in and auditing these businesses, as your testifier is going through, and the business is spending tons and tons of time, and the only resolution is, as he's hearing with the department, really is to start the appeals process, which just takes more time. So I just think as a state we need to back up on this idea that we're going to hire auditors to collect revenue for the state, because it's driving people nuts that shouldn't be, and they're just doing the best they can. But I don't think an amnesty is going to help, because most of these people didn't do anything wrong. They're just out there trying to do the best they can. But I'm glad this is here, because I think we need to have a discussion. And I've thought for a number of years, as we put money into this compliance so we can show an increased revenue on a spreadsheet somewhere, that we're really doing a disservice to ourselves.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Scoy,
you and I are in complete agreement. It's not my intention to advance the amnesty bill or proposal today. It was to bring this issue forward and say, are we really doing the right thing by Minnesota businesses to impose our budget balancing through audit compliance with an expectation that our auditors, 711 new ones, go out in our community, generate revenue to balance our budget at whatever cost, including a nuisance settlement from a business that doesn't even owe the taxes for $2,000 because it's less expensive to pay the liability than to hire an accountant to prove it, or at the expense of an appeals process. And I wonder at what point, and I think that this was inherent in what Mr. Radin said, at what point does the Department of Revenue book that revenue? Is it at the point that the auditor wrote the 26-page report that said that he owes sales taxes on the exempt hospital bills? Is that where the 4-to-1 she gets benefit for having reported that, or is it at the point that he actually writes the check or after the appeal? I mean, at what point are we booking that revenue on behalf of that auditor? And so we have our priorities wrong. We want these Minnesota businesses to go out and generate income and not be wasting all that opportunity cost and business investment in fighting the state of Minnesota over audit compliance. And in addition, I would say that it does very clearly highlight the complexity of our sales tax system and the need for us to reform it. And I know we're not going to get there this year, but hopefully we're going to get there very soon. I've heard the commitment on the part of many senators that we do need to do this, and I think it just highlights, again, our work that we have ahead of us to fix this problem.
Yep. Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Senator Ortman. We are in agreement on this, and we really have nobody to blame but ourselves, because it's not the department's fault that we've asked them to hire more auditors and to be more more active in this area. It's our fault in that, you know, we haven't been able to raise the revenue other ways or to not spend the money. But we're using this as a tax increase mechanism through audit, and we do it just to fit numbers on a spreadsheet. And I think it's really good if we step back a little bit and take a look at what we're doing to Minnesota businesses, well, and individuals for that matter, because most of them, to be honest, I think are trying to do the best they can, and it's a complicated system, and they're trying to work their way through it the best they can.
We have to remember that I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
No.
They are the taxpayers that pay for everything we do around here, and it seems like we don't treat them the way they deserve to be treated with what's been happening. So, Mr. Chair, there is an author's amendment, the A2 amendment, that I would ask the committee to act upon. And it would put the bill in the shape that the author would request before we lay the bill on the table.
Hang on, Senator Ortman. Let's hand out the A2, and then have you... do you have further testimony or testifiers, Senator Ortman?
Mr.
We're handing out the A2, and
Mr. Brown from Hennepin County is here.
Okay, so members, you're having the A2 put before you, but let's hear from Mr. Brown. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. I'm David Brown. I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney. Want to thank the committee for considering the A2 amendment, and certainly didn't ever intend to surprise Senator Ortman with this. The county attorney's representatives had an opportunity to meet with Senator Chamberlain yesterday, and our concern is really in a very narrow class of cases. We had expressed some general concerns that were in a letter to the committee members back in March. I'm not going to go into those now. The A2 amendment is really a technical fix to make sure that we don't impact ongoing criminal investigations. So we're not dealing with the audit portion of it. These are ones that are involved in active criminal investigations, and it's simply a language change to the exclusions to make sure we don't do that. Senator Chamberlain had agreed to draft and offer that amendment. Be happy to answer any questions regarding it, but this is one that... that he was very receptive to and was to make sure we didn't have any unintended consequences of passing it.
So members, see, Senator Ortman offers the A2. This would put it put the bill in the form that Senator Chamberlain, per some of his discussions with folks at the table here, wanted. And then I know Senator Ortman wants to ultimately just lay this on the table for possible inclusion. So Senator Ortman moves the A2. All in favor say aye.
No, Mr. Chair. Mr. Brown isn't certain that this is his amendment. We want to make sure that he has spoken.
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown. Ortman, thank you. The language that's in here isn't exactly what we had discussed, but I know Senator Chamberlain was dealing with the staff late in the afternoon. We have no objection to the amendment that is here, and I'm certain, based on our discussions with Senator Chamberlain, that if a further amendment is needed as it moves forward, that will be a perfectly acceptable.
Let's try again, Senator Ortman. Senator Ortman offers the A2. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say nay. Motion is adopted. The A2 has been adopted then to Senate File 652. Senator Ortman, concluding remark?
If Senator Chamberlain does have another amendment, we'll bring this bill back up off the table and adopt it so that it's in the shape that he would prefer us if we're going to leave this bill on the table. And I don't expect this bill to advance this year. We gave it a hearing to highlight this issue because, as I said, the governor has an audit compliance initiative in his budget. The House and the Senate don't, and I thought members of this committee should have information about what's being proposed. With that, Mr. Chair, I would move that we lay this bill on the as amended on the table.
So without objection, Senate File 652 will be laid on the table. Senator Ortman, then we have three more pieces of legislation that bear your name. Okay. Senator Jungbauer, why don't you join us?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Senator Jungbauer, we're back on Senate File 275.
And members, I do have a handout to explain or in detail what the what we're trying to do with the amendment.
So hang on a sec, Senator Jungbauer. So we have the A2 is what you want us to take a look at?
Yes.
Okay.
I'll move it. Yes, Mr. Chair.
And Senator Rosen moves the A2. Senator Jungbauer to the A2.
Thank you, members. The A2, I think, addresses what we talked about earlier. It deletes on line 11, on page 1, line 11, the real, and so it'll only be dealing with personal property. On line 21, we're lowering the amount to $8 million. And on page 2, line 8, we're putting it down to December 31st, 2023. So, members, what I handed out deals with the issues. Counties do have the authority to bond for personal items. And we talked about what those personal items were in this case, basically kind of a software program, something that interconnects all these computer programs so that we don't have the error rate and those issues. And the reason we need statutory authority to put it outside the normal county levy is explained again in the handout, is that it's really this collaboration of this joint powers, and so it's outside of the county's normal bill. So the county is levying for what it has in its budget, but this is actually going across 21 jurisdictions. And so it's we're asking for that authority to be outside the normal levy authority.
Madam Chair, could I just
Senator Sundrum?
I might as well just interrupt you. Yep. So, are we letting an organization approve and issue bonds that doesn't have an ability to tax?
Madam Chair and Senator Sinjum, no. This is really continuing the 800 megahertz system in an interoperability type of system. We allowed the county to do the bonds for that, and that was a multi-jurisdictional issue as well. Everybody in the county, all the municipalities benefited from that. So it's the county is acting as the fiscal agent. And doing the taxing to accomplish this across multi-jurisdictions. And actually, members, it saves a lot of money. It's what we've been asking for years, is for counties and cities to go out and work with other folks to come up with integrated systems that go across these jurisdictional boundaries so that people are working together. So under collaboration, they can actually save money. if each jurisdiction tried to come up with their own solution for these computer issues, the software issues of being able to go from one program to another or cut and paste to save this error rate, and this does save money, so it actually saves money in the long term. If each jurisdiction tried to accomplish it, it would be much more expensive than the county bonding for everyone under their authority.
Madam Chair, Senator Jungmauer, the concern that I had with the expiration on there, where current law says this section expires 10 years after the first year in which the county issues a bond or note or bond under this section. And you've changed it to 2023, but I'm reading the rationale for that, and it says extending the authority to 2023 allows the county to pay off the existing 800 megahertz bonds in 2012 prior to issuing the new bonds, so taxpayers will not be burdened with paying both projects at once. Well, if that's the case, then we don't need 2023. We need what it says in there, because it'll allow for the 10 years, because you're not going to issue those bonds until prior paying off the bonds in 2012. So, again, I'm wondering why we're putting that specific date, which is about 4 years less than the other date.
Mr. Chair and Senator Howe, Madam Chair, sorry, and Senator Howe, this is actually gives it a 10-year period from the time the existing bonds are paid off, then the new bonds go out there, so it's a 10-year period to pay back the new bonds that would be issued. So that date actually gives it a 10-year period from the time of issuance of the bonds.
Senator Howe, Ms. Zoff can talk about that.
Madam Chair, Senator Howe, I think Senator Jungbauer is correct there that reading the existing language, to me that would say that this section, this authorization in general, would expire 10 years after the first year in which the county issues a note or bond under this section. So if they've already issued a note or a bond under this section, which they have, that would have triggered the start of the 10-year period. So they're looking for an additional 10 years for these new bonds.
Additional questions or comments regarding the A2 amendment? Senator Skoy, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And members, I mean, if you had this handout, this came out, I don't know whose it is, but it says Senate File 275 on it. So we have current authority to bond for software, and it's relatively new and it's controversial. But, you know, just start to think about that. I mean, we're bonding for computer software, which who knows how long that's going to last or what kind of ability to provide long-term benefits there is. So it's extremely controversial. I am hesitant to go down a further expansion of this, but the question I have is the only reason that, maybe the Senate Counsel could help me or Senator Jungbauer, is the only reason that you need this additional authority is because they're a joint powers board?
Madam Chair, Senator Skoy, the reason is because we need statutory authority to levy outside the existing limits the county has. And since this is really levying and the county acting as a fiscal agent for these 21 municipalities, it shouldn't be on the county's general ledger, so to speak, of the county bills that they put together in their budget. It should be outside of that, and that's why we're asking for this authority.
Senator Jungbauer, is it the debt limit, not the levy limit that you're talking about, that you're trying to bond over and above the debt limit? Mr. Palumbo, is that what we're talking about here?
Madam Chair, I believe so, but I want to make double sure about that.
Senator Skoy,
and it's because
I
it's
think
a
it's
joint
the debt
powers
limit
board levy, not the county levy, that they have to have this special authority.
Well, I believe they're using the county bonding authority, but they're going beyond the debt limit.
Madam Chair and Senator Skoy, that is correct, and that's when I talked to the county commissioners. Again, they want to use their own debt limit to service all of the debts that directly belong as county expenses. This is an expense that's over and above, that's an expense that each jurisdiction could do on its own, but it would cost an extremely large amount of money to accomplish on their own. So they're trying to save money and accomplish it all as a joint powers unit.
Well, and Madam Chair, but isn't the levy being assessed on residents of all 12 counties?
Senator Jungbauer.
Madam Chair, Senator Skoy, yes, it is. It could be levied at each city, but there again, by joining together, it's going to cost millions of dollars less for the taxpayers.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. And Senator Skoy, I would ask your indulgence to support Senator Rosen's A2 amendment, because I'm going to address the software concern in a separate oral amendment that I asked Ms. Zoff to work on with a little sleight of hand while I was at the council testifiers table. She was working on one at the same time. Yep. So if you would indulge, I think Senator Rosen would move the A2 amendment. Other folks that would like to testify regarding the A2 amendment? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. The A2 is adopted. And then Senator Skoy, I had the same concerns that you do. I don't want the counties or even these joint powers boards to be bonding and paying off over a course of many years assets that have a useful life of 2 years. That's not going to be okay with me. And so I've asked her to work on an oral amendment that would address that. So Ms. Zoff, if you would read that oral amendment.
Madam Chair, members, the amendment would be to the bill on page 1 after line 19, insert personal property acquired with the proceeds of the bonds or capital notes issued under this section must have an expected useful life at least as long as the term of the debt.
Senator Jungbauer, okay with you?
Yes, Madam Chair, that's okay with me, and we addressed that on our little handout, was that it's basically an upgraded records management system. All systems in the past have lasted a minimum of 12 to 14 years, so we assume this 10 years will be sufficient.
Thank you. Mr. Palumbo, okay with you? That Senator Skoy? Mm-hmm. Senator Rosen? Okay. Any other questions or comments about the oral amendment? Ms. Zoff, would you just read it one more time for the record, please?
Sure. Madam Chair, members, the amendment is on page 1, after line 19, insert personal property acquired with the proceeds of the bonds or capital notes issued under this section must have an expected useful life at least as long as the term of the debt.
Other questions or comments? All those in favor of that oral amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. The oral amendment is adopted. Senator Jungbauer, does this bill proceed to the Senate floor?
Madam Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Rosen.
I have a question. It's somewhat in the lines of Senator Skoy's and the joint powers. Are we going to be having a lot more of these, seeing a lot more of these type of bills coming towards us? And is that a good thing? Is that a good?
Madam Chair,
Senator Jungbauer,
Senator Rosen, that is a good question, and that is something that we have discussed as a legislature for many years of getting our counties and cities to work together on projects so that they could save money and use this type of agreement. This is the only one, and that's also addressed in our handout. This is the only joint powers agreement like this in Minnesota today, and I would hope that there's more like it so that we can save money in the long run.
Senator Rosen,
Madam Chair, if we do go down this path, should there be some clarifying language what they can use this for, levy for? I mean, should we be putting in stipulations about what can be used? Obviously, this is for the public safety equipment and going forward, but this is kind of opening up a whole other set of stipulations, and it's just some. I think we need to have a lot more discussion about it.
Senator Rosen, I think that the oral amendment was offered for the purpose of at least, you know, requiring that the bonds not be used for the purchase of anything that does not have a value that will be maintained over the course of the payment of the debt. Right? And so we're not talking about, you know, office supplies and, you know, computers unless they have that useful life of 10 years. So we are getting at the issue. We may not have been very direct about it, and I think there's further work to be done on this.
I think so too.
Learning, because this is the first type of agreement like this, but there are some lessons for all of us here to say, what are we opening up and what are the next steps for really weighing in on a policy level at the state level about what is okay for the use of these bonds?
Madam Chair,
Senator Rosen,
I'm all for collaboration. However, I still like to have a little direction.
Senator Rosen, if we're not looking out for the taxpayers, I don't know who.
Yeah. Sorry.
Senator Howe, and then Senator Senjum.
Madam Chair, I'm a little concerned about the amount again, because it appears that we're given authority in excess of $2.5 million to $4.5 million more than what they project it's going to cost. And so that's up to over 50% more than it could cost. And I'm just wondering, again, you need to show a need. I can see maybe going 10% over in case there's inflation or anything that might come up. But, you know, these numbers, somebody must have put a lot of effort into coming up to this number. And I'm just wondering why we would go up to 50% over a projected cost. I mean, I could see pegging it at the high end or maybe even 10% over the high end. But I'm wondering why we would just give that authority on this.
Madam Chair.
Senator Junger, I'm going to advise that you allow Ms. Zoff to answer that question.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, Senator Howell, the limit that's in this proposal, including the reduced amount in the amendment, the law currently says that applies to all outstanding principals. So it's not just the new project. It's if they have any other bonds that have already been issued for this purpose. So the $8 million limit is a cumulative thing. It wouldn't apply to just the project that they're referring to now. If they have anything outstanding, that would have to come under that limit as well.
Senator Howell.
Okay, I guess then that would be the question I would ask, because it said already, you know, for the first phase of the project, it has already secured funding from multiple sources. Have they bonded for any of this already? Because the way I'm reading, the reason we're putting the date back is let them pay off the bonds for the 2012. So this would be a new set. So I'm wondering, not excluding the bonds that are looking at being paid off in 2012, have you bonded for this project?
Madam Chair,
Senator Jungbauer.
Senator Howell, I'll start, and then I'll let Mr. Palumbo add to that. But it's not to exceed. And we did the $12.5 million for the 800 megahertz members, we only spent $10 million of that. So given authority, not all the needs assessments from every community are done, and so it's, as you know, some of those things can come out way different than you think. We're not planning on spending more than what we need, otherwise this joint powers would be ineffective if we're going to spend more than each city might spend on its own.
That's great. Madam Chair, there is currently outstanding now for the 800 megahertz system. That will be paid up at the end of 2012. So there is some current debt outstanding.
But I get, does that mean there's no that bonding we've talked about is going to be paid off in 2012, but there's no additional bonding for this project, correct?
Currently existing, no. There is no additional bonding outstanding now for this project.
Madam Chair, and I just wanted to point out, you had a press conference that I attended yesterday, and we need to put limits on if the money's there. You know, I have faith in the Joint Powers Association, but if there's money there to be bonded for, I think we should narrow it down, and it should be exactly what the estimates are projected at, and it shouldn't be for this much greater. I can see going a little bit more, but when you're up to 50% over, I just have concerns that we're not, if we're here to watch out for the taxpayers, I certainly support what you're doing here. I just have troubles when I look at the numbers and we're going so far above those numbers. And yet we're making the accommodations on the years to accommodate paying off the 800 megahertz. So that's my concern. I just believe that personally, I think $6 million would take in everything that you've estimated for. So, you know, I'm just going to share that comment. I won't offer that as an amendment, though.
Madam Chair, Senator Howe, I always believe in these kind of cases. I believe all politics is local. And people live and die, like our county attorney here is elected. And if they spend more money, they're not going to get reelected. So, but it's better to have too much authority to get complete the project, because a partially completed project serves no one and saves the taxpayers zero.
Senator Jungbauer, I think members probably know how they're going to vote on this bill at this point. And so, Senator, would someone like to make a motion? What I'd like to do is, I think rather than a motion, without objection, I'd like to carry this bill over for inclusion in Senate File 869, which is our omnibus technical and policy non-budget bill, without objection.
Madam Chair, may I just ask?
Senator Sundrum, I'm sorry, you did have a question. I apologize, Senator.
No, no, that's fine. And I think I've come to understand it just through reading, but maybe to test my thoughts on Senator Jungbauer, Anoka County, it looks like to me, will actually issue the bonds in the full faith and trust of Anoka County and so on, will assure their payment, but only after approval by this Joint Powers Board. Is that kind of the procedurally
Madam Chair,
the
Senator
way it
Sundrum,
works?
That is correct.
Okay, thank you.
Lots of oversight, Senator Sundrum, is your point. All right, well, without objection, I'd like to lay Senate file 275 over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Technical and Policy Non-Budget Bill, Senate File 869, without objection. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members, for indulging us with the corrections.
Members, we are going to also hear Senator Roebling, but I'd like to have the lightning round, if we could, which is we have two vehicle bills that I'd like to pass forward to the Senate floor for possible use later. One is Senate File 872. It was one that was passed by this committee and included in the tax omnibus bill at Senate File 872. So I would ask Senator Hoffman if you would move to send Senate File 872 to the Senate floor. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
We're going to hold for just one moment.
Oh, you want to take $10 and you want to put it into the budget reserve?
Well, the lightning round has been called off, and we're going to move on to Senator Roebling. I think we have a couple of amendments on those vehicle bills. Senator Hoffman, will you withdraw your motion?
Withdraw.
Thank you. Senator Roebling was here before us on Senate File 405. That bill was laid on the table, and I would like to move that we take Senate File 405 off the table for further consideration. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. Senate File 405 is before us.
Madam Chair, I have an amendment to Senate File 869.
Jamie, the number she said was 405.
Yeah, thank you.
This is not clear at all. Why don't we take this bill up instead? All right. Members, I'm Senator Roebling, I apologize. Your bill was Senate File 405. I've just learned that the language for your bill was drafted into Senate File 869. So if we take up Senate File 869, we will have the contents of Senate File 405 before us. So I am going to ask that we lay Senate File 405 on the table. So that would be my motion. We'll put it back on the table. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. Senator Roebling, instead what we'd like to do is take up Senate File 869, which is the Omnibus Technical and Policy Non-Budget Bill.
So delete everything amendment.
We have
it's
a,
just being handed.
We have a delete everything. This is getting more and more complicated, Senator Roebling. I'm sorry. I thought this was going to be a little bit more straightforward. We have the A1 amendment before you all. If you recall, we've had hearings on this omnibus technical and policy non-budget bill, and I asked members if they had any concerns about any of the provisions to please let me know and we would take it out. And we took out anything that was before the committee that seemed to have any controversy at all. But nonetheless, I think that it's fair, Senator Roebling, sorry to slow you down, that we ask Ms. Zoff to briefly remind the members what the contents of this bill are, and then we'll act on the portion that includes your bill, Senator Roebling.
Thank you.
Ms. Zoff.
Madam Chair, members, the document that's just been handed out, SCS 08698-1, is a delete everything to the department's policy bill that was heard by the committee earlier that incorporates the policy bill, the department technical bill with the amendments that were adopted by the committee. As you may recall, a number of sections were removed by the committee, and then there were a couple of technical amendments and additions that were proposed by the department. So those are all incorporated in the first 10 articles of this bill. So those are the department bills as acted upon by the committee earlier. And then beginning on page 62 of this document, there's a final Article 11 with the title Miscellaneous, and that includes a number of bills that were previously heard by the committee. The first two sections are Senator Ortman's bill dealing with the revenue recapture for ambulance services that had already been passed by the committee. Section 3 is a technical addition to the bill that was proposed by Senator Tomasoni dealing with the property tax exemption for St. Louis County Fairgrounds. Section 4 is the contents of Senator Roebling's bill dealing with the definition of agricultural products to refer to game birds. Section 5 is the content of Senator Skoy's bill as it was amended by the committee dealing with the evidence that needs to be presented by petitioners in property tax challenges relating to income-producing property. Section 6 is, actually 6 and 7 are the contents of Senator Tomasoni's bill dealing with the St. Louis County Fairgrounds.
Thank you. And members, you have a spreadsheet in your packet that shows that there are no fiscal costs to any of these provisions. There's one that Senator Roebling's is negligible, and we're going to talk about that, but you'll see this in your packet. It shows the spreadsheet on the provisions of the bill. With that, I would move that A1 amendment, which is a delete all.
Right. Yeah.
Are there folks that would like to testify or questions or comments regarding the A1 amendment? Senator Limmer.
Madam Chair, I have a question on page 10 through 11. Regarding non-homestead ag property. The way I'm reading the language, it states that if agriculture land, I'm going up to top of page 11, if ag land is owned or used for the purposes of a homestead by an individual who's a shareholder, member, or partner of the corporation, then homestead class can be accessed on it, and that's within not farther than 4 townships or cities away. So a township being 6 square miles, that means that a property 24 miles away would be considered homestead if it's owned by someone who's a shareholder of that, let's say, a farm corporation, family farm corporation. Is that the intent of the law?
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, that is existing law already does provide that homesteads can extend to property that's not contiguous, but that's local ag homesteads can extend to agricultural property that is within four townships of the homestead property itself.
Council, does that reflect a similar tax provision? If an individual owned a residential property for rent, but rented it to a close relative, that property could also be considered homestead as well. Does it kind of reflect or mirror that same policy? Or how does it differ from that?
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, that is a different concept within the property tax law. You're right, there is. That I believe that was also addressed in one of the provisions of this bill, but there is in current law an exception to the general requirement that homestead property has to be occupied by the owner that would extend homestead treatment to property that is occupied by a close relative of the property owner.
Right.
But the 4 township distance is a different situation in the law.
All right.
Senator Limmer, this was a Department of Revenue clarification proposal.
Yeah. Senator, I understand it now.
Senator Skoy?
I'm on a different subject.
Okay, I think we're ready to move on to the next
Madam subject. Chair, in order to help Senator Roebling's time, I will move the A2 amendment to the A1 amendment.
Senator Skoy would move the A2 amendment. Has that been handed out to members?
Yeah.
Yes,
everyone
has
it. Senator Roebling, would you like to discuss or mention your intention with regard to A2?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. As you may recall, this has to do with game birds and people who raise them and have game farm licenses. And we were trying to figure out how to give agricultural status to those folks who actually had a farming operation raising game birds. And in current law, that is not permitted. You'd have to be raising game birds only for a licensed game preserve. But I have a constituent who is raising them for a variety of sale purposes. He might sell some to zoos. He sells some to the DNR. He could even sell some for consumption. And so we were trying to figure out how we could prevent him from going from agricultural classification, which he has had, which the county assessor now realized he is not eligible, and they were going to zone him commercial. And so, you know, it's a big difference. He raises over 1,000 birds a year, and he is trying to continue his operation. But with that change in property classification, his costs would go up so much that it would probably put him out of business. And so we're trying to make sure that we do not include too many people. Your first suggestion was that we just extend it to people who held a game farm license. We found out there are 418 game farm licenses in the state right now, and that you need a game farm license if you even have 5 birds, and so that would not qualify somebody for agricultural status. But everybody who has a game farm license has to annually file a report with the Department of Natural Resources showing how many birds they have or have raised, sold, what they did with them. It's a fairly comprehensive report that would show how many birds they actually had on their place during the previous year. And so we would like to use that report and get it to the assessor as well as the DNR and ask that it show that at least 500 birds were raised or used for breeding stock on the property during the year. And we think that this really does limit it to what would most people would consider a farming operation. I know 500, some people say, where'd you come up with that number? It's a lot of birds. Somebody who would look at an operation raising 500 mallards or 500 migratory birds would say that this looks like a real farming operation. And so I guess that's sort of how we chose it. I suppose it could be tinkered with it sometime in the future, but it seems like an adequate amount of birds to justify an agricultural operation. And so that's where we're at. We didn't include in here, however, and Mr. Vanosik pointed this out to me just a little while ago, that the report needed to be submitted to the assessor. And so he does have a suggestion on a sentence that we might add that would make sure that this report that is being submitted to the DNR would also be submitted to the assessor. I don't know if you want to consider that now or how we might handle it.
My recommendation, Senator Roebling, would be that we adopt the A2 or act on the A2, and then we can take up further amendments to address Mr. Van Ossick's concerns if the committee would like to do that. So, Senator Skoy?
Madam Chair, yes, I would renew my motion on the A2 amendment, and I've had a couple of discussions with Senator Roseman, and I think this is a good narrowing, so I would move the A2 amendment.
Senator Skoy? Senator Roebling. Senator Roseman's over there.
Oh, Rosen, I thought you said, didn't I say Roebling?
She might not know anything about game birds, because
I know a lot about game birds.
What did I say? No?
You know, one time she asked me if I knew the difference between corn and soybeans. Yes, I do. Okay, Senator Skoy would like to move the A2 amendment. Any questions or comments, or are there folks that would like to testify either for or against the A2 amendment? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. The amendment is adopted. And then Ms. Zoff has some suggested language to what we just looked at now. So it would be an additional amendment, an oral amendment. Would you read that for us, Ms. Zoff? That might address your concerns, Mr. Vanosik.
Madam Chair, members, to address that concern, the A2 amendment could be amended on line 4, after resources, insert, comma, which must be submitted annually to the assessor, comma.
Senator Roebling?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think there was a concern about the date so that we made sure that we got it to them at the right time.
Mr.
So
Van
maybe just submitted by, I think he's suggesting March 30th.
Correct, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Rob Van Osick on behalf of the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers. Just having seen the language recently, and I know the department is still looking at it as well, but a suggestion would be March 30, have the information submitted to the assessor by March 30th, which would allow them time to be able to make that change so that the property owner could receive the ag classification within that for that current year.
Thank you. Senator Roebling, are you okay with that change?
If that helps the assessors out so that they can get the classification correct, that would be fine.
Senator Skoy, would you like to make that motion?
I would move that, Madam Chair.
Ms. Zoff, will you read it one more time with those corrections from suggestions from Mr. Vanosik?
Madam Chair, members, the amendment would be on line 4 after resources, insert, comma, which must be submitted annually by March 30th to the assessor, comma.
Thank you. And members, that would be an amendment to the bill now since the A2 was already adopted. Folks here would like to testify either for or against that provision. Questions or comments? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. The amendment is adopted. Thank you, Senator Roebling.
Thank you, members.
Members, at this point, I would like to move to include Senate File 275 as amended, which is Senator Jungbauer's Anoka County Financing Public Safety Improvements Bill language into Senate File 869. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. Thank you, Senator. I would like to move Senate File 1336, Senator Fishbach's Sauk Rapids TIF provisions, into the contents of Senate File 869 as amended, Senate File 1336 as amended, to be moved into Senate File 869. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Anybody?
Aye.
All those opposed say no. Senate File 1336 is adopted into Senate File 869. And with that, members, I would move that Senate File 869 be recommended to pass and sent to the Senate floor. Questions or comments? Are folks here to testify either for or against Senate File 869, the Omnibus Technical and Policy Non-Budget Bill? Seeing none, all those
Chair.
Senator Sanger.
Probably a question I should have asked offline because I don't recall the answer, but on those very early tax conformity bills, are they still hanging out there, and is there any thoughts on moving them at all this session?
Senator Sundrum, very good question, and it's still on my list of things that we will deal with today, this year. Yet.
Okay.
The challenge is always how do we pay for it, and how do we work that into the current scenario? And we are working every day to consider how do we do that. So your suggestions and also your commitment to getting that done would be much appreciated, Senator.
Yep, thanks.
With that, Senate File 869 is before us. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. Senate File 869 is on its way to the Senate floor. Now we have, I'd like to take up Senate File 872, which is a vehicle bill. There is an amendment. This is what slowed us down before. So the A1 amendment, I believe, has been handed out. What it does is this is that bill from Senator Benson. If you remember, she asked us to allow taxpayers to pay more in taxes and direct those funds to the budget reserve. And the A1 amendment just puts in a dollar amount, $10. So I would ask folks to support the A1 amendment. Are there folks here that would like to testify either for or against? Are there members that have questions or comments? If not, the A1 is before us. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. A1 is adopted. Members, I would move that 872 be recommended to pass and sent to the Senate floor. Again, this is intended to be a vehicle bill. This language is included in the tax omnibus bill on the Senate side. Questions or comments? Are there folks that would like to testify one way or the other? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. Senate File 872 is on its way to the Senate floor.
Members, the last bill up today is Senate File 857, the Wisconsin Reciprocity Agreement. Again, this has passed through into the tax omnibus bill. This one, again, would be a vehicle bill sent to the floor for possible further amendments as necessary. Questions or comments from the committee about this bill? Are there folks here that would like to testify one way or the other regarding Senate File 857? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed say no. Senate File 857 is also on its way to the Senate floor. Members, we have no further business before us. I do not know when we will meet again. I am fairly certain that we are going to have some tax issues again yet this year. If you know of issues that need to be given a hearing, bills that need a hearing here in the committee, please let Beth Cadoon, our committee administrator, know right away. And this seems like a very good time to thank Ms. Zoff for being so incredibly capable and quick. I am so impressed, and with your team, with Ms. Pollock, and with Ms. Von Mosch, and with Mr. Paulson, and all the staff here. Incredible work. We're going to be back, but I just wanted to take a moment to thank you for helping us work through all of these bills. You've done just an incredible job. With that, members, we are adjourned until further notice.